Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It is February 24th, 2012. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the interwebs. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Good to have you back, buddy.
Yeah, it was an eventful business trip, I will say. We'll obviously talk more about it in the main topic, and I wish I could tell you all the eventful parts of it, but I don't want the show to be 4 hours long. But suffice to say, I am very happy to be back here in the home office in Tampa Bay.
Well, you know, whenever you're gone, it allows me time to actually sit home and concentrate on things. Because otherwise you're always bap, 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 bap in my ear, you know, and I can't really get any thoughts put together. You know, I try to do some work and you're like, bap, 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 bap. I'm like, dude, let me concentrate for a couple minutes. So when you're gone, I actually get some me time. Some thinking. And
nothing ever good comes from you thinking.
Well, you know, remember when I had that great tournament idea? At least I thought it was great. Having a pure...
I really thought you had that great tournament.
Well, it was a pure bounty event. Remember that?
Yes, absolutely.
And I thought that was a pretty good idea, and I still think it is a good idea, and I think a lot of people would play it. I just think that you have to get a poker room manager who can think through the red tape or whatever, which I don't even think there really is red tape. I think it's more cautious or laziness. I don't know what it is, but I think it's a cool idea. But I started to wonder... you know, when I was younger, it's no secret to the Ante Up Nation that I used to be a really competitive bowler, and I used to bowl in a lot of different leagues, and I also used to play pool, too. I didn't play in pool leagues, but there are pool leagues as well, billiards and not. And for those types of games or sports or competitions or whatever, there was always a way to put people of lesser skill on a level playing field with them. You know, sure. For instance, in bowling, it's called a handicap league, and they base it on, say, a 200 bowling average or a 220 or something. And then if your average is 180, they'll give you the difference with a percentage of it. So let's say it's a 200 average they base it on, and you average 180, and they'll give you, you know, 10%. Or whatever, the 10% difference or whatever. So you'll get like 10 pins per game added to your score to try to combat against somebody who averages 200.
Right.
Now, that's a nice way to try to average things out, try to bring everybody level. So in other words, if you're never ever going to be better than a 180 bowler, here's your chance to compete against a 200 average bowler, because they're going to give you pins every single game to try to beat this person. And the same with pool and billiards, I think. I like I said, I've never participated in them. But I'm pretty sure it's something where you play eight ball against another person, and once you determine if you're high or low or stripes or solids, however you like to call it, they take a certain amount of balls off table for you that you don't have to make, so that now you only have to make three to win the game or something. So there's a way that they sort of group these people together in their own level of skill. And then if you're playing somebody of a higher level, I think they do something to that effect, where they make them make more balls or make you make fewer balls or something. There's some sort of way to level the field. But in poker, at least in the tournaments that you and I enter, and in obviously the ones online, you have to be as good as the person next to you to play. And in other words, if you're just absolutely terrible, there's no way that you can be expected to compete against somebody. Like, even in golf, you know, golf, they'll give you strokes, you know, if you're, you know, your handicap is, you know, that you get rated by the USGA or whatever, and they give you strokes to, because they say I'm a 12 handicap, meaning you need 12 more strokes to get to par. So a lot of these sports have these ways of leveling it, but in poker, we really don't. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's because I haven't pursued it myself. But there really isn't a tournament out there that says, okay, Scott, you're an A-level player, so we're going to start you with 10,000 chips. Chris, we think you're a B-level player, so we're going to start you with 14,000 because we think you need 4,000 more chips to make that one mistake to be equal to Scott. And then so on. And I think that the way that you could do this would be a league, sort of like bowling or pool or even a golf league, where you play 3 or 4 tournaments with no advantage. It's an affordable no one gets an advantage or no one gets a disadvantage. You're all starting level. But making an affordable buy-in so people can recreationally do this. And then after 4 tournaments, you know, you take... Now, I haven't thought this completely through because I just want to see... I'm bouncing it off you to see what you think. But after 4 tournaments, you take the finishing positions of everyone, average them out, and then based on where you finished, they assign that to some sort of chip value so that when you start your 5th tournament, now the ones who averaged in the 1 spot or the 2 spot or whatever, they start with the bare minimum, 10,000. And then for each tier, as you go down, and they predetermine what the tiers are or whatever, they get X amount of chips for the same buy-in. And there are no add-ons or anything like that. Nobody can buy more to try to get even with somebody or to blow them out. Or you start with 10,000 if you're an A level. You start with 15 if you're a B, and so on. And then from there, you play the tournament. So in other words, if I'm a terrible player, but the guy who wins every week is on my right with 10,000, and I have 15,000 to start, I can afford to make a mistake or two against this guy and still have the same amount of chips that he started with, and so on. And do you think there's some sort of league out there like this or tournament idea that this could actually work?
I would not be surprised if there's some kind of home game folks that have come up with something like this and use it. I have not heard of it, but I would not be surprised if somebody writes in and says, hey, we've been doing this for 10 years. Well, maybe I'd be surprised if they've been doing it for 10 years. But I think it's a good idea. I mean, I guess the one difference, I think, between a handicap and bowling, which I'm used to more than the other things that you mentioned, and poker, is that in bowling, you're just adding pins to your score. It doesn't really change the dynamic of the game. Whereas in poker, if you're adding chips to the game, right there you're changing the dynamic of the tournament. But more so, I think, you're changing the dynamic for the individual player where it might not necessarily be an advantage. You know, for example, I suck with a big stack. So the fact that you're giving me an extra 5,000 chips, I'm not saying it's not helping me, because it is, but it may not help me as much as in bowling if you gave me 10 pins.
Well, the other thing, too, is that, you know, in bowling, there is that changing the dynamic in that if I'm bowling against a guy who, you know, I'm averaging 200, let's say, and the guy averages 140, and he's getting 50 pins or 60 pins a game, because sometimes they base it on, like, 220 is the average.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, that's a huge... See, there's only so much room for a 200 average bowler to improve.
Exactly.
Whereas a 140 average bowler can throw one strike, and now he's already reached his average, and anything after that is gravy. So they have 160 pins to improve, whereas a 200 pro only has 100. So you can't make a mistake as a 200 average bowler at all, whereas a 140 average bowler can luck into the ball 300. You know what I mean? So it changes the dynamic in bowling in that it makes this person automatically as good as you, yet not really be that good. So I wondered if there's the same idea in poker, whereas, yeah, okay, it may make you, because you're not good with the big stack, but you're not necessarily the big stack if you don't look at it that way. If you look at it like, oh, I have some extra chips to make a mistake.
Oh, yeah,
or whatever.
It's all in the interpretation.
Yeah.
I guess my point was that, you know, you survey poker players. I wouldn't say survey, because everybody's going to say, yeah, give me more chips. But if you actually do some, get our binary bunch to do some statistical analysis on this, I wouldn't be surprised if you find that the extra chips aren't as big of an effect for some players as most players would think they would be.
How about reverse it then, and instead of adding to your stack, you subtract from the better player stacks?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess it's...
That way there are fewer big blinds and stuff. Rather
that's
than...
probably a little bit better if you're talking about a league where you're playing the same number of chips throughout it and you use the four tournaments to set your handicap. So you're comfortable starting with 5,000 units. And rather than all of a sudden getting 10,000 units now because you're terrible.
Right.
But it still doesn't... It's better, but it's not completely the same as bowling, I don't think. And I'm not trying to...
No, yeah, and I don't think anything is ever the same from league to league.
I'm just saying, it's different. It's an apple versus an orange. But I like the creativity. I like the fact that that there's something to it. Now, in an actual poker room setting, I don't think they could do something like that in every jurisdiction. Some jurisdictions will... I could be wrong, but I think Florida's one of them. Where you can't start players with arbitrarily start players with more chips than others.
Hmm.
You know, obviously you have a rebuy or an add-on or something where it's an optional where everybody has the option to do it. But I don't think you can run a tournament here where you start somebody with 14,000 and chips and somebody else with 10,000 and not have that person with 10,000 given the opportunity to do 14,000. And I know that's not the case everywhere because some people, I mean, obviously, it's actually pretty common in rooms that use weekly free rolls for their guests. You know, the more hours you play, the more chips you get.
Yeah.
So,
but they still have the option to play that many hours if they wanted to.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So it's obviously legal some places, so I'm not trying to get off on a tangent. I just, yeah, I think, I mean, it kind of dovetails with, I think a poker room doing a weekly league is a good way of, ensuring that you have a lot of play on a slow night. I know one of the rooms near us does that. They have a league every week. And they do it on the slowest night of the week. And they know they're going to get 40 players in. Obviously, they're playing that one tournament. But you can count on that rake, at least. And then generally speaking, as you know, when people are in a poker room when they bust out, some of them are probably going to get up and walk out when they bust out. But, you know, you're there. You might sit down and play cash games. So I think it's an effective tool. And then you're right. If you can add in some kind of handicap element to it, then people feel like they're not just throwing their money away every week against really good players.
See,
I guess I'm curious as to whether the good players would go for this. Would
right.
Let's say, you know, we determine that you're the best player in this league, and all these lesser players come up to you and say, hey, Chris, do you want to join our league? Well, we're going to get handicapped. I don't know whether you would play that.
Well, I think there's two things I want to say. One, you know, if a lot of players sort of, let's just use Dan Negreanu as the example when he wants to play a rebuy event. He wants as many chips at his table as possible, and every time he goes broke, those chips are in play at the table, and then he's starting with a smaller stack every time he does it. So I think if you're a really good player and you know that you're playing against players who aren't really good, that it's a chance for you to really get a lot of chips at your table, or a chance for you to earn a lot of chips quickly from players who are a little less fortunate. But those players feel like they have a fighting chance against you because they have more chips. So I think that if I was a better player and than who I was going to be playing against and they were getting more chips, it really wouldn't be that big of a deal to me knowing that I'm seeing them every single week. And I'm, because that's the other part about this league too, is like when I used to bowl, and you bowled in a league, if you didn't show up for bowling, you had to pay the right. money for those games the next week because the league counts on you once you start right. that league. Right. So same with the house. If the house of, you know, card room or whatever says, hey, we're going to start this league, but if you don't show up, you have to pay the rake the next week for that week you didn't show up. People are going to show up, you know.
That would be interesting because then you're guaranteed a prize pool and you might have few. Then you're building in an almost guaranteed overlay. That's interesting.
But the thing about
this is the reason I quit bowling because I couldn't commit to being there every week and I didn't want to pay for something I wasn't doing.
Right. Well, that's the thing is that's why you don't. Then you don't enter the league. I mean, if you know you can't do it every week,
that's what I'm saying. So,
there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people actually bowling in leagues that commit to them. So I'm sure there are people out there in poker who commit to a Monday night a poker league. You know, it's like a Monday night home game or whatever. So
right, but I mean, you're making it's an interesting tournament. I just think the weaknesses are you're forcing people to commit, which is why I didn't join this Tuesday night league at the local room. They asked me to travel too much too.
Yeah.
because they make you pay if you don't show up. You have to, you know, you pay for your spot. So very similar to what you're talking about. And I'm like, you know, I'm not going to commit to paying for something I'm not playing. And then I think the other thing is just, you know, there's so many places for good players to play where they're not at a disadvantage.
Right.
You really have to sell them on the advantage. And I'll tell you, most of the players I know that like to play with the big stacks, they are fervent about it. And, you know, if you don't give them the add, we had this on the cruise once. We had one guy, hey, how come I didn't get the add? He didn't, you know, register in time, didn't get the add on. And
right.
It was like we asked him to jump over the ship and swim back to the shore. How could I compete down 1,000 units? I don't know. Play better? You're a better player than most of these people? And that guy ended up winning, going on to win anyhow. So, I mean, but the psychology of it is that that they feel like they're at a disadvantage. They don't think about their skill level. They need to have the proper amount of chips to play.
And that's the other thing too, is when I used to work in the bowling centers before I put myself through college, I used to work like behind the counter. I pretty much did it all there. But when you're at the counter and you get somebody coming up who was just open bowling for free league, you know, free. Free play, not right. In a league. They would come up to the counter, and then, you know, one of the things that we were supposed to do is say, how'd you do? And then they say, you know, whatever. And then you say, you know, are you bowling in a summer league this year or winter league, whatever it is, the time of the year? And they'd say yes or no. They say no. You say, oh, how come? You know, and then they say, well, I'm not good enough. And then you say, well, that's why we have handicaps. So you can bowl as long as you bowl as well as you can bowl, you can compete with anybody. And it's the same kind of thing. I'm just trying to see of a way to get, because you and I talked a little before the show getting.
Absolutely.
Getting more players interested. Yeah. And I knew that if I was a terrible poker player, but I enjoyed poker, I wouldn't want to play in a tournament that I'd start even against Dan Negreanu and Doyle Brunson. But if I knew that I was getting 20,000 chips and they were getting 10, I'd feel like I have a fighting chance against these guys, maybe at least to last longer and enjoy myself or whatever. So I'm just trying to find a way to, you know, encourage people to play in an environment where they don't have to be intimidated because they're making more money and they're probably playing, I mean, they have more chips and they're probably playing against people who are of similar skill, you know. But I just thought it's so weird that golf has it, bowling has it, and I know it's because it's a physical game and you're making up for physical inabilities or whatever. And then poker obviously is a mental game. But I just felt like there's got to be a way that we can get those people who aren't good enough in their minds or whatever to come to the casino and play regardless of who they're playing against. And I thought that would be one way to do it. And I bet you if you put some great minds together, because I'm certainly not one of them, they could come up with something that might make everybody happy and get people in.
Could be.
But I don't know. I don't know. I wish it could happen for them because I think that there's a market there.
Well, we can certainly talk about it at our next home game.
Yeah, because we're always lacking.
Boys do. And, you know, we had a game Friday. I was actually going to host one at my house, and then Gambit jumped in and said, hey, how about a game at my house? And I'm like, woo-hoo-hoo! Don't have to vacuum. Don't have to clean the bathroom. I'm like, I'm there. And, you know, we talked about the home game, I don't know, a couple, whatever after the last one, and how you liked it because the stakes are a little bit lower than when we have it at my house, and I mentioned that I didn't like it, but I certainly didn't mean for Gambit to change it.
Yeah.
So, shock to me, he says at the end, hey, we're going to bump the levels up so they're consistent with Scott's game. Wow, thanks. So I'm driving over there, and again, I certainly didn't think he needed to do that, but I like it better that way. And I'm driving over, and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to have some fun with him. I'm going to mess with him on, you know, hey, how about getting rid of the second deck? So it's just like my game, if you're trying to make it like my game. And I get there, one deck. Trumped me. So we sat there and we played a game at the limits I like with one deck. And, of course, you guys got all my money. So I think I think it was an orchestrated sabotage is what it was.
Yeah, you know, when you have a fish in your game, you always do whatever he wants to do. yeah, you know, it's funny. Cosenza says one thing on the show that he enjoys the home game the way it is. And what did they change it?
Oh, that's true. I didn't think about it. Maybe they actually were sabotaging you.
Yeah, yeah.
It got me. I'm the dolphin in the tuna net.
Yeah, you were the casualty, the friendly fire. You know, and it doesn't really matter. It makes no difference to us. But I just enjoy the game the other way. And the reason he had it that way was because when he first started home game, he was playing with work friends. They all weren't great players. It was just a more of a casual thing. And then we came in and destroyed it.
Yeah.
Ruined his home game. So, and I think that's why he did it. And it's funny, too, because one of the things that I wanted to bring up about the home game was pretty much we play from like 7:30 to like 1 usually. And the entire night, I hovered around being positive $5 to $30. I was never under 100, really, and I was never over like 132. So I kept going back and forth.
I was not playing for dollars. I was playing for Skittles.
Units. I was never over 32 units positive. How's that? And so, I mean, by the end of the night, it was like 1 o'clock, and I was up like 25 or so, and you had already gone, and Frank was leaving because he said he had to work the next day or whatever. So it got to like four-handed. It was Gambit, Faso, Keith, and me. And I was like, I'll stick around if anybody else wants to stick around, you know, because now it's four-handed. I like four-handed play to get more hands in. And I was, like I said, I was only up like $5-$10 or whatever. So they're like, yeah, we'll stick around. So we played for a while. And we actually, it was the latest I think we've ever stayed at Gambit's house. I think I left his house at 3 a.m., I couldn't believe it. And the lesson I learned in this game is to really, you know how they say you got to know your opponents, but this is a different level, and I like to call this the Greenstein effect. You know when you watch like high stakes, you know when you did, or you watch high stakes poker, and you see these guys getting it all in with aces on a jack, queen, nine board, and you're thinking, what are they doing with aces? Are they crazy? It's such a coordinated board. And but they know their opponent, and they know that their opponent loves to run it twice or run it three times, so that even if their hand is behind now, they'll have a chance to catch up twice, or if it's ahead, they'll have a chance to hold up once or twice. So when I say know your opponent, if you're going to ask somebody to do that, know that they're going to want to do it. If you're putting that in your calculation of a hand...
Yes. You do not want him to try the glove on if it does not fit.
Exactly. Very good. And I had it was the last, the third to the last hand of the night. It's like 5:03 in the morning. I'm up like $20 or so, maybe not even that much now. And to be honest, I was getting so bored by the end of the night. I was playing like every hand. I was three betting Faso with like Jack 4, you know, and limit hold 'em and stuff, just because I was just so... I was really bored. I don't know why. I was bored by the end of the night. So, Mark calls PLO, Mark's Gambit, and, of course, it's just one of his favorite games. So, I was like, all right, well, this could be exciting. We got a lot of cards, blah, blah, blah. And, we get it in. There's a hand. It's me, Keith, and him. And I have... I think I was in one of the blinds. And I had... ace of diamonds, seven of diamonds, queen of clubs, four of, like, hearts or something. And it's just PLO, it's not PLO8, so the ace four really doesn't make a difference. But the ace is suited, I have ace queen, and I was in a blind anyway. So, make a long story short, it gets to the flop, I have flop top pair with a nut flush draw, and I somehow misplay this hand. I misplayed this street, because... what I don't do is I don't bet or I don't raise, one or the other. I really can't remember what it was. I bet and then got called in two places, or Keith bet and I ended up just calling because it's still only top pair. I know I usually, you know, PLO, most money is determined in one on the turn. So I was waiting to see if somebody's going to take some strength on this hand on the flop, and when they didn't, I thought I was ahead, but I also had a bunch of outs too because I flopped two pair. It was actually two pair I flopped. I flopped queens and fours. And I had the ace kicker in case, you know, I needed it later for something else or whatever. And then the turn is an ace. So now I have aces and queens, and I had the fours as a backup in case it pairs that way. And but I still have my nut flush draw on top of it. So it's ace, four, queen, and then like three or something. So Keith bets out. I bet $4 into this pot, 4 units, whatever. And Keith makes it like 10. So I'm like, you know, all right, let's... And then now here comes Gambit making it 25. And so I know the turn gave him the wheel. I just know it did. And I mean, misplaying it on the flop, I allowed him to get there. So I know I totally screwed this hand up, and I shouldn't have. And I have, like, I don't know, 95 in front of me now or something like that. So I'm saying to myself, do I call here? Do I re-raise? If I re-raise, it's pretty much all my chips. Or do I get out of this hand? I have three pair, top two, and I have the nut flush draw for the backup two. So I literally have like 15 outs or something to make a hand if I'm behind the wheel. So ultimately I decide to shove, and I'm probably wrong for doing that. I don't really care if I'm right or wrong. It just felt right in the moment. I felt like if he had a set, I can get him to lay it down. And if he had the wheel, I really thought that Mark would run it twice. And I could have sworn I've seen him run it twice in the games before. I think once at your house with Snuffy. I'm not really positive, but I could have sworn I'd seen him run it twice before. So I thought he would run it twice. And I took that into account as well. I figured 15 outs twice, you know, I'm going to get my money back at least. So after a long while, Keith folds. And, of course, Mark calls. He did have the wheel. But he had no redraw or anything. He just had the wheel. So I thought, all right. But before we saw each other's hands, I asked him if he wanted to run twice. Well, he was stuck. And he's like, you know, I'm stuck. If I win this pot, I won't be stuck. I just want to run once. That's okay. I'm not going to argue with him. It's his home game. And, you know, it's poker. You don't have to run it twice for anybody. So I was like, all right. And I was nauseous because I really thought he was going to run it twice. And he didn't. He didn't run it twice, and it didn't get there, and I lost. I ended up losing like $40 that night, maybe a little over 40. And that we ran it twice to see what happened, and of course two of diamonds peeled off, and I would have made my flush, and we would have split the pot, which would have been maybe, you know, like $12 or $15 for each of us or something. But instead I ended up losing on the night. It was third to last hand of the night. So just something to keep in mind when you're playing in home games, you know, or anything, which if you're playing in a big enough cash game or whatever, just know your player. I really thought that he was going to be that type of player to run it twice for me, and he didn't, and I was shocked by that. I mean, I always think of Mark as a math guy, variance, and he'd be like, yeah, because I could have easily had the wheel in diamonds, and I'd have been free-rolling against him and giving him two shots to make his money back in case, you know, because he's always splitting with me, but if I made a diamond, he was losing all of it instead of getting half of it. So I played it like I had the same hand as him, but free-rolling, and it didn't work out that way. But what do you think about, like, running it twice?
You know, I don't know. I guess I wouldn't not do it if somebody asked, but I think it's kind of a gimmick. I get the whole variance. I mean, we're not professional players, though.
Right, we don't do it for a living.
Yeah, I think for when you're doing it professionally, then it makes sense because you're not looking to get coolered, and you need to keep the variance down. But in a home game, I don't know. I think it's more fun just to
run it out.
Just to run it out and not mitigate it a little bit. I mean, I guess if we're worried about variance in a home game, then we need to play one skittle, two skittle.
Which is what we were playing until this
skittle,
week.
Four skittle, so that's all I'm going to say about that. So,
and it wasn't that I was worried about it. I mean, obviously, $40 means nothing to me.
No, I know.
But his reasoning, too.
To do it. I don't think I've ever actually seen it done in a... I know they've probably done it on a cruise a couple times, but we've never done it in a home game as far as I remember. Or at least I haven't been around for it. So I guess I would kind of like to see it and how it plays out. That seems weird, funny to say, because obviously, and you can figure out what it means to run it twice. But I'd actually like to see it and see the reaction and actually be on one end of it and see what it does to me psychologically.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, was, you know, one of his reasonings was, he said, well, you know, I'm stuck, and if I win this hand, then, you know, I'm not going to be stuck. And I thought, well, hey, if I lose this hand, I'll be stuck. So why am I not getting the same consideration? But again, it's a home game, and it's just poker, and you don't have to run it twice. Some people haven't even heard of that. You know what I mean?
Some people
don't even know what that means. But I knew Mark was a math guy, and I thought that he would want to avoid the variance and, you know, be happy with winning. You know, because we ran it twice, he could still easily scoop it and still win all the pot. But to say that, you know, because he was stuck, that was why he didn't want to do it. And I thought, well, that's why I do want to do it, because I don't want to be stuck with three hands left for the rest of the night. You know? But, yeah, always know your player. And, you know, from now on, you know, I'll never ask him again to run it twice. So if he asks me, I'll say no, because I'm figuring
that's... See, now, you know he listens to the show, so you know right. The next time we play, he's going to ask you to run it twice every single hand. You get in your head.
But I call it the Greenstein effect, because everyone knows he will not run it twice. So that's another thing you think about. You know, if you know the player won't run it twice, then you have to think about, okay, I can't use that as an extra out or an extra reason to call now.
Yeah,
I have to be determined that this is the hand that I'm going to live and die with right here in one time, one card. But I totally misplayed the hand. I should have bet pot on the flop or something on the flop or raised on the flop. I can't remember how the action came down, but I misplayed it. I didn't get enough money in there to get him out with his what essentially was a I guess it was open-ended because he hit it with the ace. So I probably should have bet more or something. I don't know if he's going anywhere. But it was an interesting hand, and that's a different way of knowing your opponent. Usually say, know your opponent. Does your opponent raise or bet or fold or whatever? But this is different. This is, will your opponent run it twice? And I thought I knew what he would do, and I didn't. So it's very interesting.
Absolutely. Well, our hotline rang while we were gone. While I was gone.
Well, you were gone,
1-3-4-4-8-1-1-2-0. Our friend Everett from St. Louis gave us a ring, and here's what he had to say.
Hey, guys. This is Everett from St. Louis. I had a situation come at 1-2, no-limit cash game. The hand was dealt out. I made a raise of $8 with two other callers. I can't exactly recall my position, but I bet $20 into the pot. First player shoves all in for $32. That's all he had left. And then the other player wants to know what is the min raise. The dealer couldn't answer the question, and they called the floor over. And the floor didn't even know the answer to the question. And I've never had this situation come up. Finally, the guy that wanted to know the min raise raised for $54. Luckily, that was enough for me to fold. And after that, the floor finally came over and gave us the answer that $40 would be the min raise. Luckily, like I said, I folded, and a hand, they got it raised, re-raised, won the hand.
I'm not really sure what I'm reacting to here. Like, I heard the clip.
I can tell you what I'm reacting to.
What are you reacting to?
I'm reacting to a dealer and a floor not knowing a decision. And then just coming up with something and then confirming it after the fact.
Yeah, that's kind of weird.
Seems wrong to me.
No, it is wrong.
And, you know, maybe... maybe it's late at night. Maybe it's the C shift on. You know, a floor person on his first night as a floor. I don't know. Maybe there's some stuff going on here, but I'm pretty sure that's bad.
Yeah,
it should not happen.
I mean, first of all, the dealer not knowing is kind of weird, because how many thousands of hands as situations as he's seen to not know, but then they have the floor who's supposed to be the authority. Not know? That's bizarre. And you know, whenever you're playing in a poker room, you're always hearing the people sitting around you playing complaining about the ruling from the night before or something, and that's what they wish they had at their poker room, was consistency, blah blah blah. But this is just unacceptable. I mean, how do you even go back to a room like that? You know,
it'd be different if there's obviously some very difficult floor calls, and I've seen a bunch of them. In the time I've been playing, where I just like, man, I'm glad I'm not the floor trying to figure this one out.
Yeah.
This one does not seem to rise anywhere near that level.
That's crazy. It's pretty standard stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to say, and so, I mean, if, and again, maybe the explanation was different. I mean, obviously, we're getting whatever it's saying here, but it doesn't seem like it was that complicated, so maybe there's some other reason behind it, but if it played out the way Everett described it, and have no reason not to believe it didn't. I don't know how you become a floor.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Like that. So, and that's a situation where I maybe think twice about playing in that room, you know, if they allow somebody to get to that level without being properly trained, and, or at least not play during those shifts.
You know? Yeah. It's just crazy. And even for the dealer not to know. I mean, it's just basic understanding of the game to know what the minimum raise is in a certain situation when someone goes all in between. You know, was it a legitimate raise from the all in? If it wasn't, do you go back to the original bet? I mean, there's all basic knowledge there. And to not know it and then have the floor not know it is just, like I said, unacceptable to me. I How do you rectify that situation, man? You got to retrain everybody? It's crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, mistakes happen, too. So, you know, maybe we just caught people on a bad day here or something like that. But, you know, if that kind of stuff happens more than once in a room, I'm not playing it.
but that's weird, though. I mean, even to call that a mistake seems like it's incorrect terminology. That's not even a mistake, really. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just blatant ignorance or something. I mean, a mistake is, you know, oops, I grabbed a $5,000 chip, you know, on my table when I thought it was a 500 and threw it in the middle.
Right.
That's a mistake. This is, you know, it's just not, like, not knowing the rules of the game. It's just weird. That's just a bad precedent to be set in a poker room.
Well, we have set a precedent for our swag, and it's new. It's if you write in within a calendar year, you are re-eligible for swag. Everett, of course, was on the show just last month, so no swag for you. But everybody else, send us your emails. Call the hotline at 813-448-1120 if you use the stuff on the show. We'll send you something great like a grinder bracelet from Pro Poker Gear, which sells much more than terrific bracelets for home games or leagues, including hats, t-shirts, and gifts in the Annie Up store at annieupstore.com. I wonder if they have handicap bracelets for your handicapped idea.
That's a good question.
The bracelet comes with, like, it's missing a couple links.
Well, it's funny because every year we used to bowl the county and state tournaments, and we would usually compete or win the state, the scratch ones, but you wouldn't win the handicap ones because some guys will enter handicap tournaments with hundreds and hundreds of pins, and there's just no way you can make up for that. So they still gave out the same rings and the same, you know, trophies or whatever when you won, and money. But yeah, I wonder what that race would look like. Hey, one of the good things about having you know, feedback and mailbag and things like that is sometimes we can crank a show out of one of them. You know, we can get a show out of them. We've done it before with some things, and we're going to try to do it again. In our mailbag this week, Brad Jackson writes in and asks, who would you sit down to play poker with if you could? He's from New York, and he says he's been listening every Friday for roughly 2 months now. He says we're great. Thank you.
We're blushing.
He says we're perfect subway material for his work treks, which I think is interesting.
We're very popular in the bowels of urban centers.
I think that if the show came with a scratch and sniff pad, then it would be ideal for Subway. But anyway, it says, this question has been circling among my poker pals lately, and I thought it might make for some interesting discussion. If you could sit down and play poker against any five people throughout history, who would you play with? So far, the only person my friends and I can agree on is George Washington, because he can't lie. Oh, George raises? I guess I fold. He said some other interesting selections have been Leonardo da Vinci, Ernest Hemingway, Matt Damon, solely because of rounders, lots of Teddy KGB impression opportunities there, and, of course, John Malkovich drunk. More likely to do Teddy KGB the whole time. So he wants to know who we would pick, and I thought, actually, this might be a good idea for us to solicit some more top fives from our listeners, and then we'll do a show about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we want folks to take some time, think about this. Email us at podcast@anniemagazine.com with your list and why, or post in our forum or on the Facebook page or wherever you like to communicate to us with. And we'll let it go here about a month or so. We'll remind you until your ears bleed, like we always do. And then do a whole show on it, and probably turn it into something for the magazine. Just very similar to our Who's the Most Famous Poker Player.
Hey, let me ask you, does it have to be a real person? I guess it does. It can't be like...
Oh, that's a good question. Doesn't specifically say that here, but I imagine that's the spirit of it. Were you going to say, like, Yosemite Sam?
Well, I think we talked about the players in history, and I would really like to play against Hawkeye Pierce and MASH. I'd love to sit in the swamp and play in a home game with those guys. So,
well, yeah. I mean, you get the actor to
Alan
be
Alda.
A character.
Yeah, Alan Alda. I guess I'd say Alan Alda. But I really wanted to play against the actual Benjamin Franklin
say
Pierce.
Alan Alda. In character.
In character, yeah.
You don't want him from, you know, his West Wing days or something like that, you know.
All right, well, maybe that's who I'll play. To kick off my list, I'm going to say Alan Alda, but I reserve the right to change it when we do it for the show, so.
All right. Hmm.
How about you? Who do you think you might play against?
Well, I was going to say Kate Winslet. You know, I just, any opportunity I can get the closer to her. I'm sure she's terrible at poker, but I'll be happy to teach her.
Okay. That's interesting.
Well, you got to think of this question from different angles, you know. The George Washington obviously is from the angle of, hey, I want money.
Yeah,
and you can't lie, right?
So do we need to have that as a reason to, like, the reasons
Matt
why?
Damon and John Malkovich is purely for the humor involved, right? And I'm old-fashioned. I'm in it for the love.
Should we make that a stipulation, then? With the top five, submit why for each person?
I think you have to say why. We want to know. I mean, I be honest, off this list, I'm really curious how Leonardo da Vinci showed up here. Am I missing something?
For the conversation.
What, was he on Poker Edge podcast?
Yeah, don't get me started with the subtle humor. But maybe for the conversation, Hemingway for the stories.
Is Leonardo da Vinci known as a terrific conversationalist?
Well, the variety of what he could talk about, from his inventions and his...
Yeah, the helicopter and...
His theories, his painting. Hey, is that really a self-portrait of you?
That's very similar to my Kate Winslet, other than, you know, obviously I'm hoping that I can take her out for dinner afterwards.
So clearly you'd want her to come in character from Titanic so that she'll strip down naked and pose for you.
Not so much Titanic.
Okay.
She can come as herself.
She can come as herself, okay. No characters here.
We'll play later on, maybe, but yeah.
Okay.
But no, this is a great great thing. I love this. When I got this and I started thinking about it, and I'm very, very excited to hear what our readers come up, our listeners come up with, because I know it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, I think that because he sent this in, we should probably give him something, though.
Well, yeah, we're going to give something to him right now. We're going to send him a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. Folks that don't win them, you can pick up your own decks in the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com.
Sweet.
All right, our call to floor comes from an old friend, Hats and Eyeglasses. Haven't heard from him in a while, I don't think, have we?
He emailed us. No, I guess it was this that he emailed us, so yeah, you're probably right. Well, because I had a conversation with him a little bit after that, so...
But, yeah. This is what he writes in for the call to floor this week. I was playing 1-2 No Limit Hold'em in Atlantic City Casino. Pre-flop, one player was all in, and two were remaining in the hand with chips. There's a bet and a call on the flop, and on the turn, the board is 6-4, deuce 5, and the small blind, who was drunk, there's always somebody drunk in these.
Always.
You know, they really should ban alcohol at these casinos, except when I'm there. The board is 6-4, deuce 5, small blind, who was drunk, overshoves about 250 all in, and flashes a tray to the big blind.
Hmm.
The table noticed, and the dealer made him show the same card to the all-in player. The discussion expanded, and the dealer called the floor. At issue was whether the small blind's hand should be declared dead, because there's a third player in the hand, and exposing the card to the big blind might influence that player's decision and the outcome of the hand. The floor gave us a thorough explanation, but a request was made for another floor. The second floor determined that the hand should be killed because he created the problem. There did not seem to be any more basis to the decision than that explanation.
Okay, well, Jody says he's not really sure if the big blind was the other player in the pot. If he was, the player who flashed the card should have been severely warned, perhaps even asked to cash out. The dealer had no business showing that card to anyone until the hand was complete. The all-in player could have waited. In any case, the dealer should have called the floor right away and not tried to make his own ruling on what happens here, which he handled incorrectly. The hand should be not be declared dead in his book, but if that is the rule in the room you were in, then that is the rule. I totally disagree with that rule. Perhaps the guy who saw the card, assuming he was the other player in the pot, has a bigger straight. He definitely doesn't want that hand killed. If he doesn't have it beat, he has the right to bluff or fold, but shouldn't be given the pot by default. Worst case is the guy who flashed the card cost himself some money. I would have finished the hand, then warned the player and the rest of the table that further flashing of cards would result in the ejection of the offending player or players. Although it was just one player flashing the card, sometimes a situation like this is soon followed by another player doing the same thing who feels he/she has a right to one warning before being asked to leave. I make it perfectly clear that no one at the table is going to flash any more cards for the rest of the evening.
Well, the best part of this response, I think, is the one warning to everyone.
Yeah.
Because this is what I always worry about. Because you're right. I mean, poker players are sometimes like lemmings. You know, when they see someone do something, then they think they can do it. And so it's not enough to me, I think, to, you know, discipline that one player. I think, one, I always like to have a good explanation to the whole table as to what is going on. And then followed up with, you know, if it is something like this, warning everyone, there will be no more of this, no warnings for anybody else. So I'll give them that.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. And a lot of rooms have cash games where you can show cards to players, just not tournaments. You can't show cards too. So you should really ask when you sit down a cash game. If that's part of your repertoire,
Yeah. You
should ask, hey, is it okay to show cards during hands and stuff? And but I do, and I agree with you. I like the, you come up to the table and you say, the warning that I gave him is the warning for everybody. So you don't get your own warning. This is the warning. You don't show your cards. If you show your cards from now on, anybody at the table, you're gone. And then I guess it should be, that's weird. Now, would you go so far as to anybody else who sits at the table for the rest of the night gets told, hey, we already have a warning at this table, you can't show your hand?
Yeah, that kind of gets tricky, I guess.
Yeah. And then what about the rest of the room?
I think the reason you do that group warning is because of the lemming effect. If somebody saw it happen and then thinks they can do it. If it's somebody that's coming to the table that wasn't there when it happened, probably less likely they're going to do it. Because of that, at least. I mean, obviously they might do it independently, which would be kind of a weird coincidence.
Yeah.
But I'm also more curious, and hopefully Hats and Eyeglasses can write us back on this. You mentioned the floor gave a thorough explanation, but he doesn't tell us what the thorough explanation was. And so then the table asks for another floor, and the second floor determines what it's going to do. So I'm getting the feeling that the second floor overruled the first floor. I'd be curious what the first floor had to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh.
Weird. Weird stuff. All right, Hats and Eyeglasses, we appreciate you sending in. It's been a while since we heard from you, so we're going to send you a T-shirt from PMS Pokerwear, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Annie Up Store at annieupstore.com.
I think you need to read the feedback.
Okay.
Because it looks like it's edited to a version that I don't understand why it's edited that way. So let's have you read it.
I don't believe I edited it. I think I just copied and pasted.
Okay.
I'll do my best to watch.
I don't know what's going on here.
Michael Paul, your good friend now from the San Diego area, wrote, and this is in response to when Faso was on the show talking about McCall.
Okay.
And he said, I see where I edited it. I edited out the whole Macau part.
Yeah, that's why I don't know what's going on there. So,
Michael said he went to Macau too, and he said the one thing that he found odd there, although it's the land of counterfeit anything, is that when he cashed out his chips, the cashier passed every single one of them under a UV light to check a mark on them to make sure they were real. He said he found this really strange, considering that my chips were the two lowest denominations in play, and every single one was checked. But at least they were real, and I got paid out. I was not a winner, though, but only a small illusion. I basically paid for the experience. So I think what he's pointing out is, you know, they go to great lengths to be sure that the chips aren't counterfeit there, which I kind of like.
Which is weird. One, did they do it one by one, like on the faces, or did they like have markings on the sides of the chips that would be picked up so you can run the whole rack through and just glance at the rack?
The sides, because that would be for cashing out.
The other question I have, too, then is, let's say you cash out, but those aren't your chips. Those are chips. They're not your chips. You didn't come in with the same chips that you left with. There are other players' chips in that rack. If there's a counterfeit one there, what happens? You lose that money?
It's very similar to a bill. I mean, if I come in with two legitimate $100 bills, buy into the No Limit game, and I cash out for $300... of course, we'll pause to laugh about that possibility. But if I cash out for $300, I'm not getting my original $200 back. I'm getting three new bills.
Yeah, it's such a weird situation.
Could be counterfeit. I mean, there's always a risk that you're being passed bad stuff. You know what? I don't obsess over this, but I do wonder about that when I go to poker rooms. Because, you know, I'm not normally carrying around $100 bills with me.
Right.
Except when I go play poker, and particularly like I'm on a vacation to Vegas, I'll take, you know, out a bunch. And I worry if, you know, if I get a big – what happens if you get a big score in a tournament and they pay you $2,500 in $100 bills? And then you find out one or two is counterfeit, like outside of that arena. You take it somewhere else and they do a little mark on it. You're going to have to explain that, right?
Yeah. bizarre.
But, I mean, there's nothing you could do. I don't think there's anything you could do about it other than carry around one of those little Office Depot counterfeit pens yourself and mark them all.
We need to be a paperless and clay chipless society.
Yeah, maybe we can, maybe just do everything on our smartphones.
Yeah, we just need to have cards and whatever, so that way nothing can be counterfeited. It just gets credited to your whatever account it is, and, you know, when you show up at the poker room, they can't bring in fake chips because they have a card, you know, and they swipe the card, and then you're, but then we'll all be playing on these
electronic tables. Poker deck tables. No counterfeit chips there. last week's show on the Call the Floor, we had this very interesting one about chip dumping, and got some immediate feedback from folks thinking that I was too soft on them, which I'm always accused of being the soft one, right?
Yeah.
And ironically, in the same week, we had a player that was disqualified from the World Series of Poker Circuit event up in Tunica for alleged chip dumping. Very fascinating story. And we kind of wanted to devote the show to it today, but didn't have time to really put it together, and I was traveling and stuff. So, but I just want to tease everyone that we didn't miss that, and we're very interested about it, and we're going to try to talk about that in depth next week.
And we'll also bring up the argument point that it's probably not ironic that that happened at the same time. Yes, probably more coincidental, but, you know, I like to be honest.
I'll throw one of those in every week for you.
Be sure to check out our 2012 Poker Cruise schedule at antiupmagazine.com/cruise. Three great cruises this year, March 17th out of Tampa, which is close to sold out. So if you were really thinking about it, I know you're last-minute poker players, better just got a call pretty quickly. August 27th out of Port Canaveral and November 10th out of Baltimore. Okay, well, you are on the road, but the news keeps rolling in. Let's see what the Antiup News Desk has for us this week.
After an online gaming amendment was not added to the payroll bill, as many poker players had hoped, analysts now say the issue of federal online poker regulation is likely dead until 2013, or at least into the lame duck session after the November elections. And very poorly worded news on my part there. That was on the U.S. federal level. Congress. Mm-hmm. They passed this big payroll bill.
Right.
Last week.
I don't know if it's dead. I a lot of people saying it's dead, but it can still get attached to something. Wasn't it the cyber one, or was there something else it could be attached to?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thinking is that there's not another revenue-generating bill expected this year, and that's where you're going to tack it on to, where it helps generate some revenue. But yeah, I mean, anything can happen, but it does seem more likely that this will be off until at least after the elections now.
Yeah, because, you know, the UIGEA is completely, you know, copacetic with being a port security bill.
Port security, of course.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Those two go hand in hand, like peanut butter and jelly. Atlantis International Group has announced that it has inked deals with Indian tribes in California and Louisiana to allow linked online gaming, including poker.
Yeah, it's a little first step for the company here. I think they're working with some other tribes, and they're essentially going to do, I believe if I understand it correctly, you'll be able to play these linked games when you're on the casino property. So you're not going to be able to play from home. But when you're on the casino property, you can play poker against players in California if you're in Louisiana. And if they add these other tribes, you can play against them at that point. So it'll be essentially interstate in a weird way. Just not as convenient as being at home in your pajamas.
It's only a matter of time, right, though? I mean, from them to move from that to what we're all hoping to happen. I mean, I can't imagine people are going to be lured to their casino because they can play against somebody in California to play online when they could just play. I mean, I guess they can offer different. Now they can start to offer the sit and goes and the micro stakes and stuff, so that there's kind of a benefit to that. But
yeah, and bigger tournaments as well too.
Bigger tournaments too. Yeah, yeah. Bigger.
So limits. I mean, there's advantages to it. It's just not perfect. So.
All right,
and finally, lawmakers in Iowa, South Dakota, and Maryland are attempting to advance bills to expand poker in those states. Iowa's bill would allow interstate online poker. South Dakota's would raise the maximum bet in Deadwood casinos. And Maryland's would allow for table games to be added to their video lottery terminal casinos there.
It's just another step in the process. Iowa really seems hell-bent on getting this done now.
Yeah, certainly they've been very frisky on it, so we'll see what happens there.
See what happens. Hey, we get a brand new O'Malley's move this week, and this one's heads-up play, so I'll be interested to see what he has to say.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're in an interesting situation. We've gotten into an ego war and ended up making a $50 bet with one of our friends about who's the better heads-up player. Additionally, we each start with $100 in chips at 1-2 blinds, and the winner takes all. So we're in this thing for $150. We've been playing for roughly an hour, and are down at this point 2-1. We've gotten cold-decked big time. Our opponent is a very solid player, but plays more on the psychological aspects of the game rather than the math. We're on the button with about $65. He has around $135. We look down at the Queen of Diamonds, Jack of Diamonds, and raise it to $6. Our opponent does his standard raise of 2.5 times our raise, which makes it 15 to go. We know he can get a bit timid post-flop, and we may be able to push him around if we miss, assuming we get a safe flop. We make the call, and it comes down Ace of Diamonds, Queen of Hearts, Jack of Clubs. The pot is $30, and our opponent leads out for 15. We only have 50 behind. What are we doing here?
The crowning achievement for any poker player is to put a championship bracelet around their wrist. And the only company that you should trust to create it is Pro Poker Gear. Pro Poker Gear has created custom-designed bracelets and accessories for events from the United States Poker Championships and the WPT APL. Featuring 24/7 service and their exclusive Turbo Builder, Pro Poker Gear will supply your poker event with an award everyone will be talking about. Visit ProPokerGear.com and get geared.
Okay, obviously, Antiope's based here in Florida, so it's very easy for us to appear to have a Florida bias. But I gotta say, I just can't stop telling the world about the innovative poker being played down in the cutthroat South Florida market. Every time I go down there, I try to talk to as many managers as possible and some other people, and I'm always amazed at just the one-upmanship going on down there. And particularly on this trip, it was my latest into the what I call the lion's den of poker. I found plenty of good stuff to share with the nation. And, wow, what a wild trip I had down there.
Yeah, I mean, I was getting the daily reports from you, and, of course, the World Series of Poker circuit, well, that just trumps everything, the madness. I mean, it was all over Twitter, it was all over the news. I was even quoted in a story. One of the writers, our good friend Nick Sordle from the Sun Sentinel, said, "Man, this is crazy, what do you think?" And the next thing I know, my name's in the paper and on his blog, you know. Reacting to it. So it was pretty crazy down there. What was it like to actually experience it?
I kind of miss, fortunately I missed the craziness. I mean, it would be nice to see it, I guess, but I wouldn't want to be in the middle of it. But for our listeners that don't know, the very first circuit event in Palm Beach Kennel Club this year was a $500 buy-in with a $1 million guarantee on it. Totally got crazy, people crazy going for it. Ended up definitely shooting right past the guarantee. I think they ended up with like a 1.27, somewhere in that neighborhood prize pool. 2,607 entrants. And as usual, poker players wait to the last minute to enter these things. And it was a re-entry too, so if you busted out on one of the first, they had, I believe, 3 day ones, you could buy into the next one or the next one. And you know how these things are. The first day is always the least populated one, particularly here because it was a Thursday. And then people start hearing how many people in, and they get excited and want to get down there. The last day, they already did online registration for a lot of these things. They were going to give away 150 alternate tickets, I believe it was, they announced it for. People started camping out in the parking lot at 4 a.m.,
Oh, my God.
Nolan Dahl, I believe his headline on his news report was Poker's Biggest Tailgate Party. And it was. They had a gajillion people out there, from what I hear, from the people I talked to that were actually part of it. And you were just in line to get an alternate ticket. You still had to buy into the tournament, of course. And there's no guarantee, obviously, you're going to get one. They had well more than 150 people in line. Turned into a massive madhouse then when they actually opened the doors. People were calling in favors and things. It wasn't getting them anywhere. And I heard people were, like, you know, selling chairs to people so they could sit in them. And then the poker room staff was telling me that people were actually scalping their places in line, Chris. And I do not lie. Actually, I'm like, you can't be serious. And they're like, no, absolutely, we're serious. People were trying to sell their places in line for as much as $3,000.
Oh, my God.
And that just got you in line. There's still no guarantee you were going to get in the tournament. And if even if you did get to the alternate ticket, you still had to buy the 500 entry. They obviously had security put an end to it. They are not interested in people making money off of their event in that sense. But I got to say, of all the things crazy as this whole thing was down there, what's going on with people? $3,000 just to get in line to buy into a tournament? Was it really that important to people?
Well, I have one question. How many zeros in a gajillion? No, but seriously, it sounds like it's the Super Bowl. $3,000 scalping, and on top of it, you have to pay $500. And when you get into the tournament, you're starting with a handicap anyway because everyone else has been playing for however long it took to knock out 150 or so people for you to be able to get into the field. So you're starting behind as it is, and wow, that's just sick. I'm sure no one bought the $3,000 spot.
I don't know. It sounds like I think I heard people say some people bought them for $1,500 or $2,000. They're getting rumors. I don't know. So. Very well. I mean, if you really wanted to be in that tournament, I guess it's worth it to you. I mean, top prize ended up being somewhere like $125,000, I think. Hmm. It was kind of a flat payout. I think some people were a little disappointed at that and hoping for bigger money for the winner. But, you know, I mean, I guess $3,500 to $125,000.
That's a pretty good turnaround.
Yeah. And so I don't know. But. I believe what I hear is the staff was taking a lot of abuse on 2+2 and other forums for not being organized. And not that I'm going to necessarily jump to their defense, because I'm sure they learned some lessons and will be better prepared next year. But I did have a long discussion with the staff there, and it's something that it's been in my craw for a while. So much so that I'm almost going to look up what in the craw means. But I really think this is a situation where poker players have to take responsibility for their own actions. And one of the actual arguments was, how could you guys, from a player to the poker room, was how could you not anticipate that this event was going to sell out? And the comeback that the managers had was, how could you have not anticipated this was going to sell out?
Yeah.
Why isn't it dependent on the room to make sure that everybody who wants to play can get in? If you anticipate that this event is going to sell out, don't wait till day 1C and show up an hour after it starts and expect to be seated.
Right, and it's not like they can add a day 1D, because that's not fair, because everyone else is making their travel plans and everything else based on, okay, if I played 1A, I'm going to come back for day 2 on Wednesday or whatever it is, and I'm going to go home and work the other 2 days or whatever. And then you come back and you tell them that it's not that day, it's the next day. Now they got to find more time off. And you can't do that. So it's not on them. It's incumbent on the player to get there in time. Just like the World Series a couple years ago when TJ missed out. Hey, get there on day one, or get there a week before or whatever if you think there's a problem.
And it's the same thing. People were upset at the World Series then. I mean, you got to take some responsibility for your own actions. I mean, it doesn't mean you shouldn't criticize a room if you see things that they can do better or offer suggestions. But at the end of the day, if you wait to the last minute to get in the tournament, if you wait to the last minute to get on a cruise, you can't be upset if you don't make it on.
100% agreed.
It's your responsibility to strike when the iron's hot.
So it's no longer in your craw, because you got it out.
It's out of my craw now.
Wherever that was, it's no longer there.
Floating around now.
Excellent.
But no, it's frustrating because, I mean, overall, I think they put together a really good event down there, considering, again, the limitations. They added, I believe, 10 more tables. They had about 75 or 76 this year, I think. And next year, obviously, they're already looking forward to next year. They're going to look to see whether they can add even up as many as 100 tables, I think, and do more things. Certainly, they you know, you learned, you know, you live and learn with all these things. But,
right.
You know, as I tell the other poker room managers, it's a good problem to have, having 2,600 people and another 500 wanting to get into a tournament. Who wouldn't want that?
Yeah.
But yeah, the takeout for everyone is playing early.
So you got to play, too, didn't you?
Yeah, of course. I was not shut out of the horse event. shockingly, there were not 2,607 players trying to get in the horse event. I gladly would have sold my seat for $3,000, but... they were telling me they would pay. They wouldn't pay a penny over $3.45 for it. But yeah, it's the same event we played last year, and you know, I had a real goal in mind here, not only just to win, but you played last year, played very well, finished 13th, cashed, got on Hendon Mob. So you told me before I left, hey, you got to finish at least 12th, or it doesn't matter. So here's the thing, though, Chris. I gotta pick a little bone here with you, I think.
Me?
Because I know you're like the 72 Dolphins walking around saying, hey, you know, I still went farther in a circuit event than my business partner did, right?
Yeah, okay.
But just put in perspective here, last year there were how many entrants in this?
174 or something like that.
173,
yeah.
This year, there's 147.
Okay, 247, so 70 more players.
Yep, and I finished 88th this year.
Okay.
About 88th. 88 was the last number on the board, and I went on the last hand. There's probably a bunch of other people that went out. So I finished no worse than 88th.
Okay.
So if my math is correct here, you only beat one more player than me.
Okay.
So, you know, if I really wanted to be persnickety about this, I would go and see where I ended up finishing for sure. And I might have had a more impressive horse run than you did.
Hey, yeah, keep hanging on to that, buddy. I'll let you have that one. Go ahead.
But no, I was really focused on this. I want to have fun and really enjoy it. And I thought I was playing well. I just never got the big hand to get off of where I was. I think I took my 10,000 stack. I never got more than 18,000, but didn't get really low either until the blinds got really big. But we started about 45 minutes late, 5:45. We backed up at 2:40, 2:45 or so. So that's what, 7-9 hours?
It's a lot, yeah.
A lot of play, and so I got to tell you, I think it's interesting. I want to see what the folks say about it. We're getting down, and they said, hey, we're ragging up at 2:40 a.m. We're going to restart tomorrow at 2 p.m. Now, the million-dollar guarantee is still going on, and they pushed the restart of that back 3 hours just because of the crush of people and the other things going on. And some managers told me they thought that the horse restart was going to be pushed back a little later as well. Which is music to my ears, because on Monday morning, I was scheduled to drive 2 hours north to Port Canaveral to do a ship inspection for our November Antioch poker cruise.
Right.
So I was trying to do the math there, and I was going to have to get up pretty darn early, drive up there, hope there's no complications getting on the ship, which there always are complications getting on the ship, properly do my inspection, and then drive all the way back to Palm Beach Kennel Club by 2 p.m.
And not to confuse the listeners, you know, you mentioned Port Canaveral in November, but it's because we're looking at the Baltimore ship in the Port Canaveral port. Yep. I don't want to confuse anybody. Think that the Port Canaveral cruise is in November, because it's not. It's August.
Thanks for that.
You're just in case. But I don't want anybody saying, what the hell are you doing? So, yeah. It happens.
So I was looking at bagging up my chips 2:45, 3 o'clock, get back to the hotel room, 3:15. If you could fall right asleep. I'm looking at no less than 5 hours sleep. And then a four-hour drive plus some stuff to get back to finish, right?
Right.
So when we got down towards the end, I was looking at my chip stack, and I didn't have a lot of chips. So I'm like, do I really want to go through all this rushing around tomorrow to come back and go all in on the first hand?
Hmm.
It's a tough situation to be in, and obviously it's my problem because I double-booked myself for the day two. You should always make sure you're clear for day two. I mean, why enter if you don't think you're going to be able to come back on day two? And had a lot of chips, this wouldn't have been an issue. I would have, you know, thought about maybe canceling the ship inspection, doing it differently. But I got down to look few chips. It didn't seem worth it to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So second to last hand of the night, we're in the Raz rotation, and I had three low cards, so I jammed. I'm like, either I'm going to double up or I'm going to go out, right?
Right.
Of course, I did neither. I lost the hand and ended up with like one completion bet left for the last hand. And, of course, put it in there. I didn't even look at my down cards. And then I was like, God, please don't let me win. Please don't let me win. Because I don't want to have that think about the whole chip in the chair thing, right? And certainly not worth me rushing the next day to come back for three big bets, right? So here's my question to you. One, obviously that's unfortunate that it all came down that way. But I was not the only one trying, quote-unquote, trying to go out on the last hand. There are at least three people at my table out of eight of us.
Hmm.
Trying to do the same thing. Two of them had 100-mile drives to go home for the night, and then has to drive back 100 miles the next day for it.
Oof.
We're talking about this chip dumping, which we'll talk about next month. But I started to worry that, because, you know, I was like, jokingly out loud, but I'm like, you know, please don't let me win. And some player, hey, do you want to lose? I'm like, yeah, I just want to come back tomorrow. And somebody else said the same thing. Later on, I thought about, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe I shouldn't have said it, at least. Maybe I should have just played my hand out, and if I lost, boom, pick up my backpack and leave. Was I crossing some kind of line by saying, hey, I don't want to come back?
I don't know.
Is that kind of it's not chip dumping, but is it in the same neighborhood?
Well, I mean, does everybody know that you want to fold, or you want to lose?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I wasn't whispering to the guy next to me. I was standing up saying, hey, please don't make me come back tomorrow.
Oh, well, if everybody knows that you're putting it in, and your comment is to everyone, then I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Okay.
It depends. If you lean over to the guy next to you and say, look, I'm going to get it all in here, no matter what I have, so it's a random hand, so if you want to raise or protect me or whatever, you know, it's a good idea. That's a problem. If you're standing up going, look, I hope I don't win. I want to go home, so... And everybody hears you say that and everything, and then I don't think there's anything wrong with it. You didn't do anything wrong. You're telling them your thoughts, but your money's in there.
Yeah.
It makes no difference, and you're playing Raz, so they can see your up card, too, so... I don't think that's a problem.
All right, now the flip side is, what do you think if you're a player that has a good stack and you have four players that are grumbling about not wanting to come back tomorrow and obviously you're playing, or at least have the opportunity to play less than optimally to either go big or go home here?
I think it's no difference because I'm pretty sure that whether they want to go home or not, it's the same when you're getting short in any tournament, and you could tell that they're just shoving with any two cards or whatever, or looking to do it before the rebuy period ends or whatever, you know what I mean? So I think that this situation comes a lot more than just the one time where it's 2:40 a.m. and people have long drives or a big day the next day. I think this happens a lot in poker, so to isolate in this one incident and say, oh, this guy's got a problem with four of us not wanting to come back tomorrow, it happens in all walks of poker with different scenarios. So I would play my game the way I would play it, and I would play the hands accordingly. If I knew that this guy was getting it in less than optimally, then if I started with 3 to an 8, I would get it in there with him and try to take those free dead money chips because he got it in with a 10 or something. So I don't, as the big stack at the table, and I know I'm coming back the next day, I love it that you guys don't want to be around and you might be just shoving with three crappy cards. That's just how I feel. I have no problem with it.
Well, here's the true irony in this, and I believe I'm using irony correctly here.
We'll see.
The next morning, I get up early after 4 hours of sleep, drive all the way up to the Port Canaveral. No ship there. No ship to inspect. Turns out it blew an engine out and was delayed, and they hadn't communicated it to my contacts who would have contacted me. So I went through all this gymnastics the night before and drove all the way up there for nothing.
Basically, the entire trip didn't have to happen.
Yes, exactly.
From beginning to end, we're getting this whole show courtesy of a big bill that Annie has to pay for no reason, really. I guess that is irony. So, good luck with that. The problem I had back home, and it's an interesting one, is that we share a Twitter account.
Yes.
Basically, for intents and purposes, Scott does Facebook, I do Twitter. But whenever Scott does something on Facebook, it'll go to Twitter. And then Scott also likes to keep people informed when we're playing tournaments or whatever on Twitter, too. So here I am at home following his progress, and I can't say anything to him. How do I go on Any Up Magazine and say, keep it up, Scott? Or, and then it's like you're saying it to yourself. If they think, you know, at any time people get me. So I just like, what do I do? I can't say anything. So I had to like email you, like, how are you running or whatever, because I couldn't say anything on Twitter. It was pretty funny.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with positive reinforcement.
Yeah. Telling yourself that you're doing well and hanging in there. Hang in there, myself.
But yeah, overall, the circuit event in Florida is a huge success. I know their other tournaments are doing well. I'm sure the main event, I think they're expecting upwards of 1,000, which will be plenty big enough for that winner to vault to the top of our ANIA Player of the Year list. So definitely a successful venue for it. And wish them luck next year. And folks that want to come down, and Lee Childs was there, played with him for a while. I didn't play with him, but talked to him for a while when he was playing. A lot of people that I didn't see last year that came down, I think they heard how big the fields were and how well it's running came down this year. And so I imagine it's just going to get bigger next year. Certainly encourage people to get there early next year, though.
Right.
But speaking of tournaments, though, you know, obviously I talked to a lot of managers down there this year, and I think we've talked before about just how bloated the tournament schedule is everywhere, but particularly in South Florida. And, you know, the point that a couple of made said, you know, if you're a pro, and you're a tournament pro, I should say, South Florida is a great place to base yourself.
Yeah.
Not only do you have tournaments literally around the entire year, but they're drawing huge fields. So you literally don't even have to travel, live in South Florida, and be a very successful tournament player now.
And the competition's always good, too, because they try to give you more for your dollar, and you sort of pit the 2, 3, 4, 5 rooms against each other that are having these series, you know, within a few weeks of each other. So it's definitely a good place to be. And
it's got the cachet, too. I mean, we got a circuit event now. You got WPT events. So, I mean, all the big events are coming there, too. So, I mean, you don't even have to travel for those.
Right. And too, that the buy-ins are starting to grow here if you're a bigger, you know, tournament pro buy-in type of player too. I mean, we're starting to get $3,500 buy-ins and $2,500 buy-ins, and you know, those are all respectable. Those are all the size that, you know, if you the Borgata's big tournament series, their main event for the WPT is only $3,500. So I think they're on par now with the rest of the country, really.
You know, this trip was kind of multitasking. You know, one, obviously I wanted to play the tournament. The big part was seeing the cruise ship that I didn't get to see. But also, we have 3 rooms in South Florida that are recently renovated, and I wanted to get check it out myself and see how they were. First one I stopped at was Hollywood Classic, and for folks that haven't been to South Florida, or even if you have, you got the Hard Rock Hollywood, massive, huge place,
right.
And across the street you got Seminole Classic. It was the original one, and instead of closing it when they opened the Hard Rock, they left it there as kind of a complimentary casino for people that didn't want that big, you know, the walking 6 miles from your car to the thing. And they could do different things. They can do, you know, lower limit blackjack and things like that. So it's kind of interesting that they did that, and the place is always packed, so it's very successful. But they moved the poker room. It's always kind of been a small room. Well, actually, I shouldn't say always, but for the last couple of years, it's been fairly small. But they moved it to the north end of the casino. It's a much airier location, I like to call it, which is ironic because it still allows smoking there.
Is airier a word? It's like dairier.
You know, it didn't come up on spell check, so
okay.
I think it is correct. I'm going to try it on Words with Friends this week. But yeah, you can still smoke there, which is probably one of the few rooms, I think probably only one of 2 rooms in Florida that I know of that does, and not a lot elsewhere. I think it was only 2 in Vegas, too.
Yeah,
right? So
yeah.
Getting harder to find a place to smoke, which is you know, fine for those of us that don't. But if you do smoke, that's a good place to go. But they used to be this massive tournament house. In fact, actually, they did the first big tournament in Florida years ago. Used to do great sit-and-go business, and then the limits changed, and the Hard Rock came, and the market changed. So they haven't done tournaments forever, but they're starting tournaments now, I think once or twice a week. And they're going to be looking to try to restart the sit-and-go craze, which, interesting for me, I think, is when the limits changed here in Florida, sit-and-go's disappeared.
Yep, and they were one
even
of the bigger
Black
ones.
Friday.
Yep, yeah. They were one of the bigger ones that did a lot of sit-and-go's. And then they disappeared, but they're going to try to bring them back. And you and I talked a little before the show about it, that there is a market for that, because there were people who liked to do it and did it. It wasn't just because of the limits.
Yeah.
If it's done properly, I think that there's a profit revenue there.
So we'll see how successful they are, but wishing them the best of luck. Then I went really far south down the Casino Miami Hi-Li. And this is a place that was literally saved from the bankruptcy.
The Bank of Bankruptcy.
The Bank of Bankruptcy. saved from the brink of bankruptcy at the last minute. And now it's newly renovated with 1,000 slot machines, a new 24 table room, and of course it's the only room in Florida that deals dominoes.
Dominoes.
Unfortunately, no one's playing when I was down there. I really wanted to see people play dominoes. But yeah, this is a room that they closed for a while. They were having it on tough times, and they got out I believe it's like an $87 million loan. And really redid the inside. And I think the inside's very nice. It's got this nice floor plan. Kind of leads you throughout the offerings. The poker room is kind of in the middle. What they did is kind of added like an L shape around the outside of the fronton.
Mm-hmm.
So really, you just kind of walk through. You got to walk a little bit through the slot machines to get to the poker room. Depends on the entrance you want to come to. But, you know, some people like the poker room being right there in the middle of the casino because you're feeding off the energy, and other people like it segregated somewhere else where it's quiet. So if you're the type that likes to feed off the energy, this is a place to go. And it's right there in the middle. And you know, the owner gave me a tour, and we were walking through the casino, and obviously I was there to look at the poker room mostly, but I wanted to see the whole thing, right? So we get to this point, and Chris, I don't know if you've seen in the casinos these big Royal Match video blackjack machines.
Yeah, is it the electronic person dealing to you and stuff? Yeah,
electronic person, and it's kind of like a little video, and he's talking to you, and you know, they try to replicate the real life thing, because in the Pyramidals in South Florida, they can't deal live table games, so this is the best thing they can do, right?
Right.
So, two funny stories about this. The owner was telling me, and I'm not allowed to say the casino, but he says he has a friend in another casino that saw it, and we actually were looking at the room, and he's like, "This is her." He points to the dealer, and he's like, "This guy wants to meet her." And we're telling him, like, "She doesn't exist. It's computer generated. It's Disney." And he's like, no, I really want to meet her. He's like, "You don't understand. It's a computer. There's nothing to meet." So lo and behold, they're at a conference meeting somebody from Shuffle Master Build It Machines, and they're telling the story thinking the guy would chuckle at him. Did not chuckle. "I know her. I got her number." It's actually a real person.
Oh, my God. Oh.
And they actually set up a promotion in that guy's casino where she actually came and signed autographs and met him and stuff, so...
Oh, my God.
Funny story.
That's classic.
But not to take us too much off poker, but they also have this other thing called Digideal Blackjack right next to it, and they're trying both out to see whether they're successful. But I've never seen these other ones. They actually look exactly like real blackjack tables, Chris. And they have a dealer, but she's not dealing cards. She's just pushing the button.
Oh, yeah.
Pushes a button, and you have your own little video screen there. So it's almost exactly like live blackjack, but it conforms to the letter of the law because it's all electronic.
Right.
And obviously you have labor costs involved. You had a real dealer there, but I think people kind of prefer the human interaction. So they're trying to figure out whether it works out better or not.
Hmm.
So I wonder, you know, maybe, I don't know why how this would really translate to poker, but poker tech tables, maybe you build in a real dealer there that kind of manages the action.
Hmm.
Would people feel better knowing there's a live person there managing everything? Or not managing, but, you know, hanging out.
Weird.
I mean, because some people, I know I like to go, I like to have a personable dealer sit down at my table. That's part of the enjoyment for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the electronic table, I don't have a dealer, so I'm losing something there. I mean, I don't know whether I would be more apt to play the video version, the poker tech table, if I actually had a real dealer there to chit-chat to. I don't know if it's that important to me, but, you know, might be a tiebreaker for me.
Like a narrator.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Hmm.
Interesting.
And, you know, one of the things that these paramutuals in Florida like to promote, at least the ones with slot machines, are that they really like the fact that they have the paramutual concept, that that's something that you don't see in other casinos and other places for the most part. I mean, obviously there's dog tracks and horse tracks around the country, but for the most part, when you go to a casino, it's a casino. They don't have this stuff.
Mm.
Certainly this is high lie, and there's very few places to see high lie played anymore. And I thought they did a good job of opening the wall to the highlight fronton. So you feed off that energy. They feed off each other's energy. I don't think there's a lot of places there where you can actually watch the highlight while playing, though there are some slot machines, I think. But the fact that it's open and you get the feeling that you're not just in a casino, but you're actually at a High Life Fronton, I thought was very interesting there.
Especially on like a busy Saturday night when the crowd is cheering and, you know what I mean? It's kind of cool. You hear that in the background and get you all excited. And
Yeah, I would think so, right?
Yeah.
Now, this is the first phase. The second phase, they're going to do some external stuff. And just to give folks an idea, the owner and the GM went out to Vegas, and they were smitten, literally smitten, with the Red Rock Resort, which we were went to last time. Very gorgeous place, right?
Yep.
You know how the parking is kind of sunk there? So the casino is kind of like the focal point of your eye, and you're driving down the park. That's kind of what they want to do with the second phase there. They're going to build a garage that's going to use some advertising, but it's going to give that open feel. So,
Red Rock is definitely a nice... You can do worse than Red Rock.
Absolutely. Very gorgeous place. And then I drove north, the third of the new rooms, Seminole Coconut Creek, and I know I talked about this before when I went down. Last time I was down there, they were finishing the touches on building it, but it wasn't open yet. And I was telling those old folks when I got there that I went up and looked at it before we had lunch, and I was telling them, you know, when I was down there last time, they were explaining, you know, this is going to be the smoking lounge, this is going to be the heads-up tables. And you had to dream a little bit. You had to guess what it was going to look like. So it was kind of cool to me to actually go down now and actually see it done. And a lot of the stuff that I wasn't sure, I don't really know how that's going to work, I saw it in practice, and it does work. But it's definitely a gorgeous, well-designed room. It's one of those rooms where you come up, it's on the second floor by itself, come up in the elevator, and immediately there's a kind of a large lounge area there. And then the floor is a big, huge square in the middle with the tables ringing around it. So you can always see the floor, and the floor can see all the action, which I think is really cool.
Kind of like a pit boss?
Yeah, I guess.
Sort of in the middle of the tables?
Yeah, it's just very central, and it's not crowded. It's not in one place. You know, we walk in one door, and there's like 4,000 people waiting in line to sign up for the games and stuff. But you can, if you need a floor, it's not one of these things where these rooms where you have to shout from table 98 and hope somebody can hear you at the brush stand on the other side of the room.
Right.
You know, you're literally within 20 feet of the brush stand no matter what table you're at.
Cool.
But I mentioned they had this smoking lounge, and I actually call it the smoking cube. I think I was telling you about this before. It's on the second floor, right? So, and it's a non-smoking room, but they wanted some kind of concession for the smoker so they didn't have to go on the elevator all the way downstairs and walk out of the casino to smoke and come back up. So they built the smoking lounge right there where it shuts, and it has these high-powered, you know, smoke sucker things in the ceiling. And it's kind of interesting. We walked in there for a little bit. I didn't want to stay there very long because I'm not a smoker and don't want to reek of it. But I call it a smoking cube. It's very small. You walk in and it's got two chairs and those big, huge ashtrays with the butts sticking out of them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. Very minimalist. And they said, you know, hey, we want to be sure we did it right. There's no carpet in here. We don't even start a fire or anything with our... and he's sitting there showing me, and some guy walks in, lights up, sits down on the little folding chair, and just loving it. The other thing I was very interested in is they have two heads-up tables. And they are, I like to say, they're so cute. And then I apologize. I'm like, I don't want to describe them to these guys as cute. But they are. They're like, you almost feel like you can put your keys on them as a keychain. But they're built for just two people and a dealer, very small, and they've been getting a lot of use, he said. I mean, they've been playing a lot of heads-up cash games, real high-limit heads-up cash games. And then they've been using them for the tournaments. When they get down to heads-up, they move people to there. Kind of cool. I really kind of want one for home, to be honest.
And that's what I think we talked about the last time when you brought up the heads-up tables, that's what they would probably do with the tournaments, is when it gets to two, move them over so you can have that big table for cash games if you need it or another tournament or whatever. So that's pretty smart.
Dedicated bar and big nice lounge chairs there. So I mean, if you're waiting for a seat, you can go get a drink and relax and read Annie up. Very well designed for the player comfort, I think there. And then they built this TV table room. It's a high limit area, and they've been getting some real good pros coming in there playing high limit games at night. So it's secluded off to the side, but the TV table is a TV table. It's got the little whole card cameras already built into it. They're adding a flop camera and DVRs and everything. It's all set up. I'm sure some of the bigger rooms probably have these tables somewhere, but I don't think they use them every day.
Right.
So definitely it's a step up in the high roller kind of thing, I think.
It's kind of expensive to have that table just be an everyday use, though. It's kind of a risk.
I mean, eventually, they're going to use it for what it's intended for, but right now it's just... it's kind of the version of a Bobby's room. It's a glassed-off place.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can't... I mean, unless you're up on the high brush area, you can't really see into it. So, you know, it's got that anonymity for the people that want it.
Cool.
Surprisingly to us, they're launching a World Poker Tour regional next month. Put it together kind of quickly. It's got a variety of games. I think they're doing a 7-card stud, an Omaha 8, PLO, and a heads-up tournament. So some variety for folks like us that like to do some other stuff. So we'll see how that goes. And speaking of doing some other stuff, we were at lunch and he was talking about a couple games that they've been dealing. They've been playing this 4-card stud 8 for a while up in the high limit area. And then they just got approval from the state to run Mexican poker. And so when we walked back to the room, they were training the dealers how to deal the Mexican poker. He's like, "Hey, Scott, sit down. Let's play a couple hands." And it was awesome. I'm calling both of these at the next home game. So here's how they are. I want to see what you think about them. First, the easier one to understand. 4-card stud 8. And like I said, they're trying to figure out what to call it. That's just what they call it now. But they don't think it's actually got a real name. So they're thinking about actually branding it now. Because it's called the Stacks Poker Lounge there. They may call it Stacks. Stack stud.
Okay.
But it's 4-card stud 8. It's just like normal stud 8, except players are dealt 4 down cards and must discard 2 after the initial action. And for some reason, they have the high card bringing in. But they play it with no limit and with antes.
So in other words, you're dealt 4 cards down and then 1 up.
Right.
And then you're dealt 2 more up, or 1 up and 1 down?
No, it plays just like stud 8, but just at the initial thing, you're dealt 4 cards,
okay,
rather than 2. And then after you bring it in, after the bring in all that, I guess we'd call it pre-flop action, everybody has to discard 2 of your cards.
Okay, and then, you, so then it's just
like
stud 8 after that.
Pineapple stud 8.
Right, okay. So you discard 2 and then it's just stud 8 after that.
Yeah, and so what they mentioned is, you know, it's an action game because now think about your starting hands.
Yeah.
When you have 4 cards to start with and you pick the 4 you want. So the first hand I played, I got ace-ace XX. No, boom. Threw away the XX, of course. So I had buried aces with a 2 showing.
Jeez. And it also limits how many players can play the game.
Yeah, in fact, actually, because we were playing, obviously, with funny money there, no one was folding, so we had to do the little always fun spinner at the end.
Yeah.
The community card, which is hilarious, too, because I turned over my cards, I'm like, I missed my high, but I got my low. And then I started putting my cards in order, and I'm like, shoot! I'm 1 card short. Oh my god, I misread my hand. And then the dealer's like, "Don't forget about the spinner here.
The spinner.
You got a low." I'm like, "Oh, thank you." But I don't know. What do you think about that? It's played no limit too, rather than limit.
Yeah, the no limit thing is crazy.
Imagine how big those pots get. And that's where they said they've been playing it for a while up in the high limit area.
The no limit thing is just—it's hard to wrap my head around. I mean, when I play cards with my family, we always play no limit because if you play limit structure in a 3-handed tournament starting with, you know, small blinds or whatever, it'll play all night. So we always play no limit, and so I have some experience with it. But with a real money no limit, that's in a cash game, not a tournament. That's,
yeah,
wow, that's going to be some serious action.
Well, I'll tell you, the manager there, Pablo, real interested in getting different games started. I mean, he's really cut from the Antioch Poker Cast cloth there.
Yeah.
You know, when the limits changed, he really tried to get limit games going down there, and like every manager failed in that way. It's just impossible to get him going here in Florida for whatever reason. So I think adding no limit to these games makes it an easier bridge for the no limit players.
Yeah.
Because I think it's more the limit that holds them back. So, you know, give me the choice of no limit hold'em or no limit stud. I'm going to play stud every day, I think.
The other thing, too, is that when you play stud 8, a lot of the strategy is to make sure you have a hand that can scoop and start with a low if you can.
Yeah.
But with no limit, you can force a lot of hands out. I mean, you're really going to want to draw two more cards to try to make a low.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when you know that somebody's probably going all in with aces, you know, underneath, or if you're rolled up, you never have to worry about your hand getting, you know, split or whatever, because you can just bet enough to get people off their ace, deuce, 7-8, you know, or whatever.
Right, absolutely.
Wow, yeah. Some serious different strategy now.
I think we might try that in the home game. Maybe not no limit. We'll start with limit, but okay. Just having the extra cards, I think, adds a little.
Yeah, it's like the crazy pineapple of stud.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the next one is the one I really love. And, you know, we just got back a couple months ago from California, and lots of rooms out there play Mexican poker. Never actually stopped to watch it. And no doubt there's other variations out there rather than the way that they're playing it here. So don't flood my email box saying I'm wrong. Just flood my email box saying here's how they play it here. But this is how they're going to play it in Coconut Creek. It's a five-card stud game. It's using a standard 52-card deck, but they strip the eights, nines, and tens from the deck.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And then they add one joker to it. Now, here's how the joker works. If it's dealt face down, it's a wild card. It can be used any way you want it. So you can make it a pair of twos or whatever, right? But if it's dealt up, it can only be used as an ace or to complete a flush or a straight.
Right.
So some strategy involved there.
Right.
For some reason, flushes beat full houses in this game, but the rest of the order is correct, or normal. And any cards that connect through the missing 8, 9s, 10s complete a straight. So, for example, if you have a 6, 7, Jack, Queen, King, that's a straight.
Right.
Because it is a 5 sequential of what's a possible, right?
Right.
All right, so you with me so far?
Yep, yep.
All right, now they play at no limit here, and they play it with blinds. And you're dealt two cards, one down, one face up. After the action, you have the option of turning your down card face up. If you do, then your next card is dealt down. And if not, the next card is dealt face up. So everybody's got the same up and down cards, just in a different order.
And it's just for that one street, right? You can't keep doing that.
No, no, every street.
So every street you could turn the one that's down up and get a down one?
Yep.
Absolutely. Oh, wow.
So obviously the strategy is the joker, which is funny because there's only one in the deck, right?
Right.
So, I mean, the first hand I was dealt deuce of hearts, tray of hearts. And, of course, we're playing funny money and stuff, right? So almost everybody turns their card up. I'll leave mine down because I want to conceal that I have a flush moving, right? And one of the dealers I was playing with is like, you know, hey, you really should turn that up because if you get a wild card next time, it can only be used to complete an ace or a flush or a straight.
Yeah.
Which I wanted to say, well, I wanted to complete a flush, so it doesn't really matter. You play your hand, I'll play mine. But I think it was obviously being helpful. But a lot of strategy involved there.
Well, that's a sick game. And I think that it might have been Hoyt Corkins won the bracelet in 87 in this game.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not sure. But of course, I'm joking. It's my subtle humor that I have to turn now into obvious humor.
Yeah, I thought I heard that on the Poker Edge podcast.
Somebody to tell me that he has not won a bracelet, we know. I don't know, whatever, but I don't really care. But, wow, that's a sick game. See, that's the other thing, too, is I don't know if it's worth the hassle in our home game to do this. Strip out the eights and nines and the tens every time you want
to
call the game.
We have a second deck. I mean, we could play the gambits.
Yeah, second deck. Just meant for this game. But I have a... My stepson Charles plays poker with some friends, and they're a Filipino family, and they play this game.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the joker part of it, but they play it with the eights, nines, and tens removed, and I think that the full house gets beat by a flush because of the odds of there are fewer combinations of the suits or whatever. So, a very sick game. I think they may play it seven card.
So.
Wow. Well, if you want to call it and just get another deck preloaded or pre-removed or whatever, so I'm going to sit there and wait. Otherwise, we're going to start the clock and wait for you to strip the 8s, 9s, and 10s out and explain the game during that time so we don't have to waste that. But sounds like fun.
Although I'm sure you could play it without taking the 8, 9s, 10s out, right?
Sure. You could play it the same way. But then just the full house is now beat everything again. And
Yeah. And the straights, and but I'm sure there's a reason to do it.
And then it's just called Roll Your Own, really. It's like seven card stud, Roll Your Own.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're going to add the joker or not.
Yeah.
Very interesting trip.
Right. Hey, this is Hoyt Corkins, and I'm listening to Annie Up.
Ooh,
we just talked about four card stud eight. Just talked about Mexican poker. Now we're going to talk about No Limit Omaha 8.
Man, where are these freaking games coming from? It's the beauty of poker, but it's also the ugliness of poker.
Yeah, it is. It is. All right, well, this is coming from our new friend, Andrew. He has no last name or location. So yet another one of our listeners in the Witness Protection Program. But he is a listener all the way back from week one, Chris. And he says he remembers the ding of the elevator in Columbo's One Minute Mysteries before Faso did the voice work. And when we'd scream at each other about not revealing what happened on this week's WSOP telecast. We ever screamed at each other, did we?
I don't know about that. Maybe behind the scenes.
But a great memory there all the way back to those fledgling days for us.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did mention the No Limit Omaha 8. So he says it's the regular weekly 1-2 No Limit Omaha 8. And he says, yes, that's right, 1-2 No Limit Omaha 8. Regular weekly game they play with this.
Wow.
You'd go crazy.
Yeah, I would call in sick.
Every week. Now, he does say No Limit Omaha 8 is not for the faint of heart. I have no trouble believing that. He said he could probably send us a hand of the week from this game every week. Hey, new segment. all players are fairly familiar with each other's game. Buy-ins are 100 to 200, although if you're stuck 400, you're allowed to buy in for 400 or more. Interested to think what you think about that.
Has anyone in our home game ever had $800 on them ever at one time in their life?
Well, okay, so let's say buy-ins are 10 to 20, and if you're stuck 40, you get to buy in for 40 more.
I like that idea. Might as well give somebody a chance to win their money back. I like that idea.
Well, you know, I like it, but I mean, what's interesting is what if you're stuck like 380?
Well, like, was the 400 number just a? Well, did he pull 400 out of the air just to give you an idea of how, or no, you could buy in for? Does it have to be 400?
200. If you go broke, then you can only buy in for 200. If you go broke again, then you're stuck 400. Then you can buy in for 400.
Hmm.
The object is to try to get your money back, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's regulated.
I just didn't know if like you bought in for two, then bought in for one, now you're stuck 300. Can you buy in for 300, or do you have to actually be stuck 400 before you could do this?
I think you got to be stuck 400. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. So if you're stuck like 350, do you just go wild crazy at the last 50 so you can
that's rebuy, crazy.
Buy in big?
I'd say let anybody buy in for as much as they want. As far as how much they're stuck. I mean, if they're stuck 500, they should be able to buy in for five. They're stuck three, you should be able to buy in for three. If you go felt, you should be able to buy in for whatever amount it is that you're felted, not this random $400 number.
Well, I mean, I guess another way is when you go broke, you can buy in for the max at the table.
Yeah, and max stack is another way max, to at least help it out.
Yeah, so if you go broke in the first hand, then you can buy in for 400 at that point if you want. That might be a better way to do it. You're right. Well, it's their game, so we're not going to
talk about it. Yeah, no, I'm just saying, in our game, I wouldn't want to do that.
It says eight players left the table. A few have gone home broke. That would be me. And one has cashed and a pretty big winner. That would be Keith. We're about 6 hours into the game at this point.
Jeez.
And the the stacks range from 89 to 1250.
1250.
And our
wow.
hero is the one with 1250.
Wow.
Show off.
Brag.
He says the game usually has a lot of limp pots with many callers. Pot is raised about one-fourth of the time pre-flop, usually to $8 to $15. The small blind, who has 89, has recently rebought and has not been hitting a lot of cards. Big blind is about even for the night at 525.
Hmm.
Not sure how the math works with that. But and of course, our hero is up about 900, and he says, of course, he's run it up.
Well, the big blind could have gone broke and then won back the money he went broke to get to that, so it could be anything.
Under the gun plus one is up 75. He's at 275 now. Under gun plus two is stuck about 300, down to 115. Hijack stuck about 200. A lot of people stuck.
Yeah, well, do we really need to know all this?
No.
Okay.
It's kind of curious, though. Button's up 300 if you care.
Okay, thanks.
All right, our hero is dealt the king of diamonds, king of spades, jack of clubs, ten of clubs.
Okay.
And look at, he even puts in a waiting for you to say what I should do with a big blank in the email.
Well, where are we again?
We are under the gun.
Oh. Now it's 08, right?
08.
I have to admit that I'm not a real big fan of playing cards that can't scoop if there's a low. I mean, I realize high hands can scoop if there's no low, but that's a big if. I don't like playing hands like that, and none of these are the nut hands. I'm probably going to play it. I don't know if I'll play it for a raise. Unless I probably would play it for a raise. I probably would play it for a raise if I'm going to play it. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
He said 8 to 15 is what the usual raises, I guess.
Yep.
I'm probably going to raise here. Because he said that people tend to limp, because you know they're limping with all kinds of hands. This is the kind of hand where I want to get those marginal lows out. And if somebody's going to call along, I'm going to have a feeling that they had low hands, so I can play it that way. I mean, again, I don't know how this game plays, but if it's 08, people are playing with low hands. So
yeah,
I'm probably, if I got a lot of people playing the hand with me, they'll probably have a lot of lows, and I'm the only one with the high. Could be that situation. So I guess if I'm going to play it, I'm going to play it for a raise. And since he plays it, I'm raising with this. So I'd probably make it 10 to go.
Okay. This is the hand I like when I'm on the button and there's been a lot of limping involved.
Right.
This is where you know that everybody's really going low. All the low cards are out, particularly the aces, because I have my kings.
Right.
And so two things. One, it's less likely that a low is going to make it on the board, so I can scoop with this hand. And two, that the aces are out, so I don't have to worry about my kings getting beat by an ace. Not that really the one pair is really what I care about, but... And we got connecting cards too. We got we got clubs going as well too. But under the gun, it's a different hand, I think.
Yeah, and that's the other thing I wanted to say too is position is real important. I would love to have this in position. I hate having another gun. Absolutely
now,
hate
I
it.
I also like having it when I'm sitting on 12:50 and the next closest person to me is 5:25.
Yeah.
And most people are well below that. So at this point, if I've been running that good, I'm going to feel a little frisky here and put in a raise and see what happens. But I'm going to be very cautious on the flop, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I would rather thin the field with this hand than just limp along, let a bunch of lows limp along with me. And
oh, definitely, yeah.
So I don't want to just limp here. But
and the other thing, too, about raising here, too, is usually when you're under the gun, people are going to put you on aces or ace-deuce or something like that on Omaha 8, so your hand's somewhat disguised.
Yeah.
So if you hit, like, that king or all high cards and you bet out, you might get raised by someone thinking that you missed and you're just putting your C-bet in.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, the fact that I have a lot of chips here, I think I can get away with making a raise here and seeing how it goes. I'm not going to get too crazy with a pre-flop if we get re-raised, but this is a hand that kind of Omaha. This is kind of where you build up your capital. You need to start converting it.
Would you ever consider folding this hand at this position, this, the way it's come down?
Oh yeah, if I'm the short stack here, probably. Sure.
Yeah.
I just like the fact that I have the big stack, but no, normally even in a limited game, I'll probably be folding this under the gun.
Yeah.
I just like the fact that I've got some chips here and I can experiment a little bit.
I mean, you have really no nut draws. I mean, yeah, if the ace of clubs, queen of clubs, jack of clubs, ten of clubs, whatever, king of clubs comes or something, but obviously that's not going to happen. So,
well, we don't know. I mean, that's what's unfortunate about our position is we don't know what people have.
Yeah,
when you're on the button and you have a bunch of limpers, that's when you can start factoring in a bunch of low cards are out. But when you're under the gun, you're the first to act. You don't know. I mean, it may not be. No one may not have an ace.
Yeah.
And you might raise and take it down, or you may get one player heads up. You know, all this stuff could be good. What you don't want to do is raise to 25 or 15 or 25 and get everybody calling.
That's right.
All right. All right, so you were going to raise to what?
Like 10, I guess.
10. Okay. Yeah, I'll probably raise to about that. I guess if they go all the way up to 15, I might go to the high end just to really kind of thin the field out as much as I can.
Yeah.
Our hero limps, disguising his play. He says he's been raising and flatting with big pairs. This hand has no low possibilities, but could scoop with all the big cards on the board. That's straight flush possibilities, though the flush is not a nut, of course. The flop comes all red or wheel cards. I can get away from this easily. That's a very good point. That's another reason I like playing four Broadway cards, is because your hand is extremely defined on the flop.
Yeah.
You know, if three low cards come, you know, boom, I'm gone. In a minute. There's no reason to stay in. But our hero goes on to say, I like to play this pot multi-way pre-flop rather than chasing everyone away early. I can also call a raise or re-raise the pot as raised later. I can kind of see the fact that, I mean, again, if you reverse it and you're in position and there's a bunch of limpers, you want it because there's a bunch of low cards. So I guess I'm not particularly scared about a multi-way pot. knowing that I'm not going to commit a lot unless I hit the flop hard.
Right.
But I don't know about limping. I'd rather bet it and get that money around. Because remember in Omaha 8, too, when you have, like, you're not going to get chased out. You're going to chase out very few ace deuces pre-flop. Very few ace trays. And so get the money now when they still have hope. And then when that flop comes all high cards, not only do you have a strong hand now, but you've gotten that money out of them that they're not going to put in now. If you limp now and that happens, you're not going to get any more money out of them.
Yeah, and now when he says he can also re-raise if the pot gets raised later, so I'm assuming he's saying that if one of the blinds or the button decides to raise, and then when it gets back to him, there's enough money in the pot that they can make a really big raise and take it down. I'm assuming that's what he means.
Yeah, I think
okay.
So.
Okay. Because that could get the ace trays off if if you're looking at somebody behind you making a 10, somebody else, or like we did, make a 10 or make a 15 like you want to, and then someone else calls, now you got 30 in there, now you could put 15 more in to make it 45, then make it 45, so now you're making almost 60 to go. Somebody with ace tray, and even ace deuce may let it go because they still have to draw to hit the hand that they want to hit.
Right.
So that's an interesting play. I just don't know if these players are going to do that, since he said 25% of the time is when they raise and 75% is when they limp. So you're taking a chance, big chance there. 3 out of 4 times, everyone's going to limp. So I don't know if that kind of tactic is the best to try with this under the gun, but we'll see.
All right, so he gets 3 callers before the cutoff folds. The button calls. Small blind raises to 10, and the big blind calls, and it's back to us now.
Well, given his comments, he can now call 8, which would make it 2, 4, 6, 26, so 8, 34, and then make it another 34. He can literally make it like 42 to go now or something. Is that his intention? I don't know. I wasn't playing the hand that way, so it's hard for me to now do what he was thinking of doing.
Yeah, my only fear about raising here is I don't want to get re-raised again. I don't want to get into a raising war here with this necessarily, but if I feel confident that I can, my raise will end the raising, and I'll get some people to call it, I might pot it here.
Well, the thing about that is the small blind, if he has any kind of hand, like ace, ace, deuce, whatever, he's going to get it all, and he's only got 89 anyway.
Yeah, that's the danger, yeah. Small blind has aces, which is normally, if you're raising with a small blind, that's very likely holding there. You know, he's going to re-raise you again, and you don't want that with your kings.
Because what's the point of raising there anyway with all those callers behind if you're only making a 10? You know, well, you know what else, too, is I forgot it's no limit, it's not pot limit. So when he was saying before, you can make it 42.
Yeah, that's true.
So you can make it whatever he wants. I don't know why. I'm just so used to making it PLL 8. But
yeah, it's kind of weird to play no limit.
Yeah, I guess he could have made it any way he wanted. But
no, I guess you're right. I mean, I don't see anybody folding for $8 here.
No.
I could be wrong. And we already have the small, big blind calling, so might as well just call here, and we get a pretty decent pot there, and we'll see what happens on the flop. I guess that's what I would do.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, in his mind, he was saying something about he could also re-raise, so I don't know if that's what he wants to do here. If that was his intention, then we need to re-raise, because what was the point of playing the hand if that was your plan, and you're not going to follow through on that? In other words, if he said that he would never limp with this hand unless he knew he could re-raise with it and that he was going to be an opportunity, then why are you playing the hand? So
that's true. That's true.
Anyway, me, I probably would just call, hope to hit a set, or you know, all middling cards that I could connect on straight-wise.
There's lots of flops.
There's a lot of opportunities, so
nice,
I'll probably just call.
all right, that's what our hero did. He said, in this situation, he likes playing against a small blind as he could be tilting and not a real threat to my stack. Again, the small blind is what, 89. I guess that's the other point. If it's pot limit, that would be a good way, because then you're limited on how much you're getting in.
Right.
He says he stacked small blind off several hands ago, and though he might be looking for revenge. Always like playing against people looking for revenge. he did say the big blind could threaten a good portion of his stack and is a very good player, but I have position. Which is kind of funny to think you're under the gun, but you have position. But you do.
Yeah.
And he's not too worried about what anybody else might do.
Okay. Well, we call. What up happened after that?
Yeah, we get 3 more callers. We only lose one player. So yeah, 6 players to the flop. Pot of $62. Flop is king of hearts, 9 of hearts, 5 of spades. Small blind pushes all in for 79. The big blind thinks about a minute and calls.
And what did the big blind have? Is he that 500 guy?
Yeah, he's got 525.
So he's the one that can hurt us the most.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, God. I mean, obviously I'm not folding. I have top set.
No, I don't think anybody's going to ever think about folding.
It's just whether or not we're going to re-raise. That makes no difference. You don't have to re-raise. So what's the point of even talking about it? Because re-raise isn't going to do anything. It's all in. You can only call. He's the second biggest stack. So if you call, he's all in. Everyone else
is... No, he just called. He just called the 79.
Oh, he called 79. That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. I think I'm raising here. It'd be great to shut him out so that, you know, what kind of hand could the 525 guy have, you know, set of nines, and then you want him to have a set of nines. Is he really going to call off his whole stack for a draw? Probably not. So I like isolating. It's a pretty decent pot now. I like isolating, you know, with that dead money out there and shoving. So, I mean, I would probably shove, because if I'm making it three times the bet, you're looking at $200, $300 bet anyway. The guy only has 500, so I'm shoving.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the effective stacks is what you got to think about.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, I mean, if I lose, I'm still up. I still have 700.
Well, I might not shove. What I might do is bet 525, which is the same thing. But I just think that shove is scary to people.
So psychologically, you're thinking
that. Yeah, there's some psychological there. I mean, it depends on your players. I mean, if you're playing with the same people all the time and they're very smart, then they're not going to fall for that. But I think there is some psychological to it. I'm all in, and they know you have 1,000 there, and you push it all in, and they're looking at it like, oh, forget it. Whereas if you just say 500, it sounds like you're making a calculated raise, even though for them it's still an all in. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I mean, you know.
Effectively, it's the same thing.
I think I want to make it enough that the big blind can't fold either, but I don't know. I'm always
in raise.
That's the problem, is I think when we play these games, when we're doing the hands of the week, we're always looking for a way to isolate instead of get the most money out of somebody. So maybe I do just make it like 300 and try to get the big blind to come along. But there are some straight and flush possibilities here. The guy could easily have ace, deuce of hearts, and that's why he's calling the 89 or 79 or whatever it is.
I'm not so much worried necessarily about that. What I'm worried about is we don't have any backup.
Yeah, hand, right? We have nothing else.
We don't have hearts to fall back
to a boat.
On.
Yeah,
we really our only backup is the boat.
We could have a queen.
It's not bad, obviously.
A queen helps.
A queen, yeah, that's true.
But really, we're really hoping for the board to pair and not to give somebody quads.
Yeah, and it's Omaha 8 too. So if we keep it too low and we keep some low draws in, then
runner.
They could have a runner, and I don't want to lose half the pot. So it's always a big decision in Omaha 8. I mean, are you happy with all of the smaller pot now, or are you willing to risk losing half of a bigger pot later on?
Yeah, I guess maybe I might make it like 300, because I don't really have a problem with the guy with 500 coming along here. I'm trying to get his money if I think he has a set of nines. Maybe he'll reshove, and then I know I have the best hand, at least physically the best hand. I don't know if there's probably some statistic hands that maybe beat us.
We can also, this is what I like about Omaha 8, is you can start, you get a much better range of hands than you do in No Limit Hold'em. I mean, the small blind, obviously we don't know. I mean, raised pre-flop, very likely had aces, and he pushed all in, but we don't really care about that 79. The big blind, thinking about for a minute, you're not going to think about it and call with just a naked low draw when a king 9-5 and you got a shove already.
Right.
So you got to think he's got a high hand. So we have kings. So, you know, if he has a king, the best he could have is king 9 or something like that, which is unlikely. So maybe if he has a set, I don't think he's going to be thinking about it necessarily, right? For 79, although maybe you might raise more.
Right.
Right, so I mean, really, I got to put him on a flush draw here, don't you?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that the fact that he thought about it means he has to have a hand. It can't be I'm going to hope to get my backdoor draw. So it could be something like, it could even be like multi-way, you know, hand like what did I say before, ace of hearts.
Yeah.
Could be like ace queen of hearts, which now gives him, you know, I guess backdoor Broadway. Maybe he has ace queen 10. Or something, and he has Broadway draws, flush draws, overcard. So it could be one of those hands, and that's why he's thinking about, should I raise or should I just call to get somebody else in here? You know, and that could be why he only called a 79 instead of repopping it. So I think no matter what we do, is this guy does have that draw. He's not going anywhere. Right. So maybe we should just shove.
So yeah, should we make a? We should make him.
Make him pay the max. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe shove or make your 500 and 479 bet or whatever the hell it is.
All right, so our hero says he thinks about 2 minutes and analyzes the situation. The pot is now 220. We have top set with a gut shot straight draw. Currently the nuts with a redraw to the nut straight and top full house, but no heart redraw. I have no low possibility, but the board would have to come running low cards to make a low get there. I figure small blind has nothing. It's just pushing, hoping to double up. I figure big blind has some kind of straight wrap. Queen, jack, 10x, 8, 7, 6x, etc. Or maybe a lower set. I don't know about the lower set, but possibly. Big Blind and I have played some sizable pots previously over the last month, and I really like to stack him at this point. And even if I can't, there's a lot of money already in the pot. So he pushes all in for my remaining 1240, effectively only 515 to cover the biggest stack left of the table. I figure this pushes out some of the weaker draws and lets me isolate with Big Blind for a nice side pot or just a main. So,
yeah, it's pretty much what we came, the conclusion we came to. Of course, you got the other people in the hand, too, so who knows what the hell they have.
All right, so our next two players fold to get out of the way, but the button calls off his remaining 395.
It sounds like it's
what, I wasn't expecting this, he says.
Definitely sounds like what we thought it was. I mean, unless he's got a set of nines, and even that,
well, this is the
doubt.
Button, not the big blind.
Oh, the button. Oh, it's not the 525 guy.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, interesting. Well, maybe he's got that hand that we talked about then.
or at this point, he could have a set, too. Which we don't care about. But yeah, at this point, I mean, there's only so many different hands available.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of bored. And we had the best right now, so our hero says he wasn't expecting it, but didn't exactly mind it either. He says the button is generally passive and will call off his chips with non-nut hands. I assumed he was calling maybe with some kind of flush draw, maybe ace, deuce of hearts, and maybe also had a pair of fives or something in there. At this point, of course, it didn't matter if the decisions were made. I don't know about... Oof, boy. If he's the type of player that's going to call off here with a flush draw, I want him in our game.
Yeah, it's...
Kind of assume he has a set or a monster wrap of some sort.
Well, right. I feel like that hand that he has could be the hand that we were describing for the big blind who just called.
Could be. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it could be the suited ace.
Yeah, and I think they could have similar hands.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they both have hearts and straight draws.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be like queen, jack of hearts for somebody, and ace, ten of hearts for the other, or something. You know, it could be some weird combination where they both have pretty high heart draws and Broadway draws and a pair or something.
Yeah.
I don't know if somebody would do all that with a set of nines, knowing that you just shoved. What are you shoving with $1,240?
Yeah, there's two shoves and a call. Yeah, I think that's time to throw your set away, so... Yeah, we're probably up against two very similar draws, which, to be honest, is good for us.
Yeah, yeah.
Have each other's cards out of the deck.
Yeah.
All right. So obviously, the small blind's already in. The big blind thinks about 2 minutes, realizes he's in a spot. I prefer to call it pickle. Pickle sounds funnier than spot, right? And folds, saying he would call if the button hadn't. Again, probably. I mean, maybe he had the weaker of the draws.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Main pot 378, side pot's now 632.
God.
And our hero is saying, pair the board, please pair the board. Small blind announces, I need runner.
Oh no.
Turn is the deuce of spades.
There's one.
Our board now is king of hearts, nine of hearts, five of spades, deuce of spades. Small blind announces, that's a good card for me.
Oh no.
River is the four of hearts.
Oh, no.
So our final board, king of hearts, nine of hearts, five of spades, deuce of spades, four of hearts. Small blind announces, that's a very good card for me. Small blind shows, ace of spades, tray of diamonds, six of spades, six of clubs. Push with basically nothing. Terrible.
So he made it 10 bucks after all those limpers with ace, tray, 6-6 because the ace was suited and he had the second nut load preflop.
Yeah, it's definitely a calling hand there, and see what happens.
Well, I'm dying to know what the button had now. It's got to be hearts.
Chose ace of hearts, king of clubs, queen of spades, jack of hearts.
Oh man, so what a cooler! First, he's seeing that the guy has top pair, top kicker. He's got a straight draw, a nut flush draw. See, now this is exactly what happened to me in the Monday night, or the home game we had. I basically had the same thing. I had all these outs and the nut draw, and none of it got there. Of course, it gets there for this guy.
Yeah.
Brutal. So he loses the whole thing.
Button takes side pot of 632 with ace high flush, no low. Button takes half the main pot with the same flush. I'm sorry, with his flush, and small blind takes the other half with the wheel.
Wow. Oh, man, that's sick. What
and
a
he
pot.
He says the big blind never revealed what he called the original $79 bet with. So our hero says, my question is not did I play this right, because I think I did, even though an ugly river cross cost me a $1,000 pot. But more, what would you do, and have you ever played No Limit Omaha 8, and what might your strategies be?
Well, I think we sort of talked about what we would do all along, so I don't know if I'd address that again. I think that I would have raised or re-raised with this hand way early. And after that, the decisions were pretty easy for us, really. I mean, just calling isn't really an option after that flop. You have top set, and you got two guys in the hand with you now, plus two more behind you. I think that you have to raise there. So, and really, the raise seems to be the effective stack. So I don't think what we would do really matters now. Have I ever played No Limit Omaha 8? Yes, I have. I think we played it for a couple of rounds in Jason's home game in Connecticut before I said, this is ridiculous. Why are we playing No Limit everything? And then we changed it up. But and I've played it in our own, my family home game, No Limit.
I think I played it online once or twice. But here's the thing about No Limit Hold'em or Omaha 8. I really don't... Pot limit's what makes that game.
Yeah.
It makes you... Because it constricts your bet. I mean, still, obviously, you can get a lot of money in a pot and pot limit. I mean, those games are sick. So it's not like you're limiting the amount of money you get in, but you're creating more decisions and more strategy. No limit, it's just... I think you take a lot out of the game. And if you go to like the Full Tilt Strategy Guide that we always mention, a really good book, the Omaha chapter is really good, and I don't remember the math and everything, but they said the proper... It was Howard Lederer wrote that, maybe? That the proper move in a no-limit game is with pocket aces is to shove.
Right.
So that's why you have the pot limit, so you can't do that, and it's more layered. So I guess my suggestion is don't play no-limit anymore. Face the pot limit. And the game will be more fun. But if you're going to stick with no limit, then yeah, I think you're going to want to do a lot of shoving pre-flop. You know, take advantage of the fact that there's no cap.
Yeah, I mean, it looks to me like I now start to incorporate more of my hold'em strategy.
Certainly.
In this game, and you want to force the ace trays out. You know, and in this case, too, we're not results oriented, but if you went back and you did what we wanted to do, which was possibly. What he initially wanted to do was say that he could pot it again or whatever, raise again, when it got back to him after the small blind, he made it 10. Now he makes it 40 or 50. The small blind shoves on him to make it 90, and then you re-raise or whatever you can do there. Then you're heads up with that guy. Sure, he'll make his wheel and low, but you only lost 89 instead of 525 or whatever, you know. So I feel like if you're playing this the way you should have played it, you should use a no-limit strategy and...
Yeah, and it's actually a very good point. Yeah, the more we think about it, we really should have got it all in pre-flop.
Yeah, because you have king-king, the only hand you're behind is aces, and the one likely person to have aces is the small blind who made it $10 there.
And low draws cannot call all in.
Right. How can you call 500 without a made hand?
Right. Yeah, so really at that point you're only worried about aces. And at that point we thought the small blind had him.
Yeah.
So.
And you're not going to fold this hand. So... I don't know. I mean, if you knew somebody had aces, I guess you would just fold, too.
That's exactly why you don't play No Limit Omaha 8. It takes the fun out of it.
Yeah, it takes the fun out of it. But again, I do think that anytime you tag on that slash 8 to a game and it's not just regular limit, I think it's the devil's game. It's just a blasphemy.
All right, Andrew, we appreciate you playing the devil's game and the satanic version of it. And we're going to happily send you a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft. It's not no limit, but still fun nonetheless. But you don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store. And remember to send your hands of the week to podcast at AnnieUpMagazine.com.
I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. contact us at podcast@anyupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@anyupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.